All right, good morning. I will call to order the regularly scheduled Board of Supervisors meeting for this Tuesday, August 29, 2017. And before we get started, so fairly full agenda, clearly at least one topic that we're going to have a really interesting conversation on. Board, I would like, since we've got a discussion of Squaw Creek, and specifically we're going to be talking about a Squaw Creek Bridge later, unless there's objection, I'd like to pull Darren Moon's portion of our agenda, which is 15-1 and 15-2, up to immediately following discussion of Squaw Creek, which is item 7, so that we can have the full conversation without taking a bunch of people's day away from it as they sit and wait for us to get to that.
I have no objections.
Second thing I would ask is anybody who has their cell phones, please put them on silent. It's just a little distracting if we start getting getting phone calls. And finally, if everybody please join the board as we honor America with the Pledge of Allegiance. I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all. Well, thank you and good morning again. First item on our agenda, as always, is public comment. Number one is an opportunity for members of the public to address items on today's agenda. Anybody wishing to do so can come up, but I'd say this. If you feel like you're going to have comments or potentially have comments about the Squaw Creek Bridge, if you'd be willing to just hold on and we'll make sure we hear from you during that conversation, that would be my preference. That said, if you want to speak to it right now or speak to anything else, now is the time. Please come right on up to the microphone. All right, seeing no one moving to the microphone, we've got a presentation this morning, presentation of awards to Assistant Jail Administrator Micah Anderson and Deputy Kyle Thompson for the work they have done with Interpol. And we actually have Robin Anderson, who's a U.S. Marshal, with us today. Sheriff, you and Robin coming up for this?
Yes.
Sheriff, and I'm sure you're going to start here, but just in case, give everybody just a real brief synopsis of Story County's relationship with Interpol.
How many people are in Interpol?
190.
We have an opportunity that began in January of 2016, and with that, working with Interpol and started from the time I was president of the National Sheriff's Association, and we formulated an agreement where Interpol brings people from across the country, from other agencies, in for an opportunity to interact with other law enforcement agencies at the federal level across America and also other countries. Currently, Interpol has 190 countries in Interpol, including the United States, and we started out, we send people out for 6 months at a time. And our first detailee was Deputy Elizabeth Quinn, and she started at Interpol, and her first assignment was human trafficking. And so now we come back, the state of Iowa, as you know, has recently created a human trafficking division, and she continues to be involved with that and continues to have that connection and reaches out with Interpol today. After her, we've had Micah Anderson do a six-month detail position, excuse me, and then Deputy Kyle Thompson just came back in July from his detail with Interpol. Now we're on somewhat of a hiatus as we get through some personnel issues in my office, and we hope to be through with them in another somewhere between 3 and 6 months and be back at full strength, and then we'll revisit becoming back engaged with Interpol once again. So that's where we are now. So I can turn this over to Deputy United States Marshal Anderson.
Thank you very much for having me. We greatly appreciate it. I was telling you before the meeting, we couldn't do the state and local program, which I'm in charge of, without the assistance of state and local departments across the country. In fact, we're in talks with Monmouth County, New Jersey, which is a world away from here, but valuable nonetheless. So thank you for that. Should I give you awards?
That would be fine.
All right. So I started at Interpol. I've been with the Marshal Service for 4 years. I was actually an Iowa State graduate, so I kind of started here and processed with Marshal Service through Des Moines. So it was like coming home, so it was a great opportunity for me to come here. But I was allowed the opportunity to start at Interpol in January, and I had a one-week crossover with Micah, so I don't know him very well, but from everything that everybody has said at Interpol, he was a great asset and gave us tremendous insight from his state and local level. So the first award is for Micah. If you come up and join me. If you can't hear me, just let me know. It says, thank you for your dedication and commitment to the Interpol Washington mission, from the director. So, thank
you. Good job, Micah.
And Micah can get a heck of a sunburn, let me tell you. And the second award is for Kyle, who I worked with for 6 months. And I didn't know that there was anybody who would work harder than I would, but this young man is so incredibly dedicated and gets there in the morning before everyone and takes advantage of networking opportunities and getting to know the area that he was in more than anyone I've ever seen. So, Kyle. And his award says exactly the same thing. So to you, from the director of Interpol, thank you very much.
And if it's okay, let's do one more photo op. Mike, you and Kyle both right down here. All of us.
And Liz, why don't you come up too?
Yes, please.
Kyle, you're over in the middle for sure.
I am?
Absolutely.
It's not because I'm the tallest.
Yeah, of course. Yeah.
Everybody slime this guy. Everybody good?
Got it. Yeah.
All right, next item for us today is discussing consideration of HERS request to use Story County as a social media outlet to promote community informational forums. Deb, do we want to wait on Julia, or do we want to go ahead with this one? All right, so we're going to hold that one and see if Julia Castillo, CEO, makes it this morning. Next discussion is traffic control options for the intersection of 190th and Grant Avenue. So this is further down 190th than I think our major conversation is going to be today. But to tee this one up, as the county is paving the portion north of 190th along 530th, Grant, Gretton, Hyde, depending on where you're standing on the road. And we were talking about the very real need to start to control some of the speed along that stretch of 190th. The board made a decision a couple months ago, I'm going to say, that we would turn that into a four-way stop at the intersection of Hyde and 190th. Did, in fact, do that for about 6 hours and found that there was some real issues with getting people to recognize that there was a stop sign there. And so County Engineer Darren Moon asked that we reconsider and discuss this further. Did I set it up about right?
There's no consideration on the agenda. I just wanted to update it since we did decide on this at a board meeting. I wanted to bring it back. Like you said, we tried this about a week or two ago. The only reason we did try this is Moose Road, West 190th, we call it. And then this is Grant Avenue. City of Ames is paved up to Moose Road, and we are paving this as we speak and putting a bike lane, a separated bike lane on the side. So we're concerned, one, with how those bikes are going to get across in the future. They're going to have to cross here and come down, because you can see the city's already graded their bike trail, but we've come to find until this develops, it could be a year before they put that bike path in. That might be the earliest it could go in.
And Darren, the reason why the county chose to put our bike path on the east side of the road instead of the west side of the road to butt up against CMS?
Mainly three reasons. One is the schools on the east side, the new school at the north end, so we wanted to match in with that. Two, originally Ames had theirs planned on this side when we designed our road. And three, we have a major drainage district tile that goes in the ditch bottom over here that we didn't want to cover up with the bike path. So those are the three main reasons. So we discussed how we would control this intersection in the future. We decided we would go with a four-way stop. I'd say we put the stop signs up a couple weeks ago. Actually, it only was about 2 hours.
Okay.
That's all I needed to see. We actually had an orange road work ahead sign. We had a stop ahead sign with an additional flag on the side with warning. And then the stop sign with a flashing beacon at the top that was pretty bright, easy to see. I'd estimate 50% of the traffic blew right through it. Didn't even see it. It was a little surprising. I knew there'd be some issues, and I wouldn't have tried it if this leg was open. It was closed at the time, so we didn't have any cross traffic. That's kind of why we put it up at the time we did, to see if we had any of those concerns, and there was those concerns. We watched it for about an hour or two. Like I said, about half the traffic was blowing right through the stop sign. Even as I left, I was going northbound here. There was a westbound car with the trailer on the back, and I swear he was slowing down. I pulled out left, and he about rear-ended me, took me out. So at that point, I'm like, this has got to be taken down immediately, because this is actually a City of Ames stop sign on the south side. This was ours. It's the City of Ames, so it was a cooperative deal. So we contacted the city to come right back out. They took theirs down as well. So I knew in the short term they couldn't stay up like it was for safety reasons. Whether we put it back as a stop, four-way stop, or not, something we need to discuss in the future. My recommendation is probably not to go back with a four-way stop. And part of that, it's really hard to see here, but the intersection is right about here, but it is so wide open. People just don't expect to be a stop condition there because it's so wide open, easy to see. So they're not expecting it, and people are just so used to going through that road without a stop. The only thing we could do additionally is probably put out those huge message boards warning of that stop sign if we did put it back up. But
they probably rumble strips if you need to do that.
I'd like to find out how much it would cost to put rumble strips in.
To me, the rumble strips are concerning with how much that neighborhood is building up. People don't like rumble strips in the front yard. Mm-hmm. With the houses they're going to build around there, I have a concern with the rumble strips. The cost is pretty minimal, so I don't think the cost is an issue. It's $2,000 to put those in, but I think we need to think about it. Further down the road at GOD Car, we've already had to fill some of those rumble strips in because of that reason. Right next to a house is not a pleasant thing to have. But it's an option we still talk about, but I have a concern with those.
Yeah, so I think the first thing I would say is, from my perspective, I think you're making exactly the right call of not having these up at this point while we consider more. That said, this board did, in fact, establish that as a four-way stop. So if it's not going to be a four-way stop, we need to consider that again. Right. And make that change. So I think I would ask that you go ahead and get this on our agenda sooner rather than later as a consideration item. And we just talked all the way through, including the possibility of rumble strips, how we're going to control the future crossings there for bicycles and pedestrians, and what our plan really is. But if we're going to rescind this idea that it's going to be a four-way stop, I think that needs to happen as a board action.
I found your story interesting personally, not only because the guy went through it, but that he almost hit you. And of course, we're looking at when we're talking about bicyclists versus car, and we are pretty sure who's going to win that collision and who's going to lose it. So your story is even cautionary from this guy wasn't paying much attention either to you even. Yeah. So what happens when their bicycle is out there?
Well, so worst case scenario is a bicyclist thinks that a car is going to stop, as Darren did when he was pulling out. You think the car is going to stop, and then the car doesn't stop. If it's the onus of the bicycle to make sure that it's clear both. The beauty of this road is, while you get little pockets of heavy traffic, one of the reasons we see the speeds we see out there is it's generally one or two cars at a time coming either direction. And I know that that is a I know that some of the motorcyclists love to get out there and really open things up out there. It's been a speed road that I've been concerned about for years. We just need to make what's going to be the safest long-term decision we can make. I thought we had made that. Really interesting to me that people just don't even acknowledge when you put up a stop sign.
And I think we're making a more dangerous situation than what we're trying to solve. I see that pretty quickly. The other thing I wanted to point out, we will have this bike path built here in the next month or so. So it's going to come down here. I'm thinking for the time being we might have to just put up some signs that say end bike trail until we figure out, one, with the city of Ames, how we're going to get it across here, and two, it's not built yet, so there's really nowhere to go. The city is curb and gutter, so there's no shoulder to drive on. They're going to have to come out on the road for at least a year now, so I think we probably need to just put up signs saying end of bike trail, and then we figure out with the city what we both want to do for a safe crossing. And we talked about from the very start our concern with the bike crossing. City of Ames is doing a lot more of those push button and the flashing lights come on. But with a 55 mile an hour highway, there's a county that experimented with that. What happened is if you go on 55, all of a sudden those lights would come on and flash, and they didn't know what to do. They slam on the brakes and get rear-ended.
Right.
So that's what we were trying to avoid by doing the four-way stop here. But I think we're probably going to end up back with some sort of bike signs and a bike crossing rather than a four-way stop. But we need to discuss it more and come up with a collaborative solution with the city of Ames.
Actually, so two things. One, I would ask first, sooner rather than later, you get the rescission of the four-way stop, at least in the interim, because where I think we might be in a little more jeopardy is, right now we've said, the county has said, this is going to be a four-way stop, and it's not. So we need our action to mirror what we're actually doing out there.
Sure.
And then we can have further conversations as you talk with Ames about what ultimately that's going to look like. Marty, Loris, any other thoughts?
Refresh my memory. The city of Ames weighing on this with you?
They've had little input at this point. I need to just get them to sit down in a room and say, this is half yours, you need to be part of this discussion.
I'm surprised.
For the most part, they said just do what you need to do.
Okay.
Thank you.
Good. Okay. I don't see Julie yet, so we'll go to discussion of Squaw Creek, and this will lead us to a discussion of Squaw Creek Bridge. Luke Graham. Is Luke here? Yeah, Luke, come on up.
Thank you.
How are you today?
Doing well. Thanks so much for having us.
Absolutely. So closer to one of the square microphones that are beeped right there. You're welcome to sit down if that's more comfortable for you. If you want to stand, you can sure stand right there.
Yeah, I'll stand. Can you hear me okay?
Absolutely.
Okay. I'm a forester, a private forester, so I get to help landowners learn about trees on their land. And in addition to trees, we help take care of prairie, wildflowers, and streams and wetlands. Kind of a holistic land management, natural ecosystem management company. We have about five staff based southeast of Nevada. And one of our clients is here with me today, Dick Van Dusen, and his wife, Marjorie. They own land near Squaw Creek, just south of the 190th Street Bridge there.
Uh-huh.
And I guess I'd like to invite Dick up at some point. Now's as good a time as any. Dick called me 3 or 4 years ago and said, hey, we got this great prairie and we're ready to have a good burn on it.
Uh-huh.
Could you help us burn this prairie? And it's surrounded by houses, you know, so it's not the easiest site to burn, but we did a great job burning for him, and had the smoke go north and west just like we wanted to. And I noticed immediately that there's this stream that's really unstable and unhealthy. And I maybe a year later, I said, hey, you know, maybe we should look at those trees together and try to do a better job there. And And Dick's like, absolutely, this is a big priority for me. I'm concerned about the stream, and I've been actively researching what some options are to take care of the land. Is that a good introduction?
Yes, good start. I will sit down and get closer to the mic. So,
Dave, introduce yourself.
I am Dick Van Dusen. I've owned in partnership with David Hughes the land in question in 19 and 20 of Franklin Township. This farm, 57 acres, was just deeded to the Iowa Natural Heritage Foundation as a life estate. So when Dave is no longer with us, that's the trigger that will turn the control of the land entirely over to the Natural Heritage Foundation. The long-term intent for use of the land is public, and it has been restored to prairie through a CRP program, and it is a lovely area. Our concern, and why we're here talking with you, is that the stream, because of increased flow rates from upstream with tiling and all the practices that have contributed to erosion, the stream banks are eroding inordinately. And when Luke and I met each other and I finally found out that, hey, there is somebody around who can maybe help, we started talking about it. And since our discussions began, we've included, again, the county, Hillary Olson.
Natural Resource Conservation Service.
And also now the Iowa Rivers.
Prairie Rivers.
Right. Folks have gotten into the discussion as well. And it turns out we have a lot of common interest in this thing. So, really what we want to do is bring it to your attention, let you know that certainly the bridge itself on 190th Street is one point where some good practices in terms of how the water flow is controlled through there and perhaps erosion is remedied would help a lot with what happens downstream on the farm land itself, or the Natural Heritage Foundation land. And then as you follow downstream, practices there can be instituted that would reduce erosion, slow the advance of water downstream during flood times, and not eliminating clearly the impact on the city of Ames, but it can help reduce the impact on Ames during flood times. So that's kind of the background of this whole thing. So Luke and Lee Searles have a little bit to tell us, and
The only thing I would add to what you said, and really appreciate all of it, the other thing that happened since the time you guys began talking about all this was the Squaw Creek Watershed Authority was also created about 24 months ago. Prairie Rivers is the administrator of that watershed authority. And so while this is a very key practice that's being talked about along the Squaw Creek, this is just one of many practices that we're looking at coming in the entire stretch that is Squaw Creek. And we're excited about all the different entities that are included in the Squaw Creek Watershed Authority all the way up to into Hamilton County and really pulling in a lot of different resources to try to address some of just exactly what you're talking about. Because it's not a localized problem. It's the entire Squaw Creek that we're dealing with.
No, and we have spoken a number of times about the value of starting a project here and inviting other people.
Absolutely.
upstream to.
Well, a journey of 1,000 miles starts with a single step, and, yeah. and you absolutely were that first step along here. And then a lot of different, almost unrelated factors started to come together. Now it's important that we start to pull all of those together. It's one of the reasons I'm so appreciative that you guys are here this morning. And thank you for your commitment.
You're welcome.
Before we go any further, could you please help me more clearly identify exactly where the, your land is?
Yes, may I approach the bench?
You see the red line?
Okay, here's
the red line across 190. Right.
Here's the bridge.
Okay, got it. Okay, thank you.
Here's the bridge and the land. This is part of it, but it extends down. Lee is standing right in the middle of our farm. Yep.
Okay, thank you. All right.
And it basically, sir, runs along the east side. Right. Not entirely on the east side.
Most of the land is on the east side of the creek.
Right.
And on the east side. So right on here.
It's between the creek and Squaw Valley subdivision.
Correct. There, folks. And then you got Hickory Hills on the other side.
On the other
street.
Side of it. Yes, that's correct.
Oh, all right.
Yep. Beautiful property.
Okay. Let Lee and
Luke
tell you more.
Luke.
Luke, do you
want to?
Yeah,
sir.
That's okay.
Stay anymore, or I can kick it into gear.
Yeah, I just want to bring to the attention.
If you just speak somewhere near that square one that's on the.
Oh,
yeah,
we'll
pick that up. That's a good one.
So here's just a quick visual of what this site looked like in the 1800s. This is a map of the historic vegetation survey that was done. A crew of about 3 to 4 young men, 16 to 20 years old, walked across the state, and every mile they drove a post into the ground at the section corners. And they wrote a little note in a beautiful cursive handwriting, maybe a sentence or half a sentence. Doc be nothing but trees here, just a wet swamp, you know. And so from these little scribbles in the 1800s, in the 1990s, Iowa State University researchers thought it would be a good idea to digitize all that those little scribbles and make a map that kind of shows what Iowa might have looked like in the 1800s so that land managers today can kind of help use that data to understand where we are and where we might go forward in the future. So the green, lime green outline is the Dick Van Dusen and Dave Hughes property, now owned by the Iowa National Heritage Foundation, south of the bridge there. And you can see it was just covered in trees. The dark green was representing trees, oak trees, hickories, walnuts. And then beige, this beige color represented wildflowers. Prairie wildflowers, diverse community of maybe 300 different species of plants. In the 1930s, this is an aerial photo taken, which all this data is available on the internet for free, and you can see a bunch of trees still in the 1930s with some open pasture. And then in 2010, this is an aerial photo with a color infrared sensor that shows that the land use in 2007, 2010, somewhere around there. So it was a tilled crop field, and then Dave and Dick enrolled it in the prairie, tried to restore wildflowers. They put in like 40 different species of wildflowers and grasses. You know, so it's an excellent stewardship practice in a highly volatile floodplain situation. But because of the modification of the stream, which Lee's going to talk more about, they are not getting all of the ecological benefits from the stream function that they could be getting. They, as individuals, and us as a broader community, we're not getting the ecological services that we could be getting from this degraded stream that's lost a lot of its functionality. And foresters, the ecological managers, know how to interpret the natural conditions of a stream, what a healthy stream looks like, and then we can figure out really innovative ways to bring some of those degraded sites back to a higher functioning system.
So I'm Lee Searles, and I've been working with Luke on the stream issues on this property specifically. And one of the things that we do that's a little different from, say, the Iowa DOT or some other entity is, rather than taking an engineering approach to solving everything, we're not against engineering, we use it. We go at it from the ecology of what's going on And so in looking at ecology, we're taking a bigger scope of things, including the entire upstream watershed and what's happening, land uses, how those are affecting a specific point on the stream. And this point on the stream runs, for our purposes today, from the 190th Street Bridge through the Hughes Van Dusen property. The bridge itself has experienced quite a bit of scouring at the bridge abutments over the years, and so the abutments are threatened. And there are ways of solving that with some natural stream restoration processes. And we had the pleasure of meeting with Darren Moon and others at the site to talk about some of these issues. So at the bridge itself, whatever the fate of the bridge is, whether it's rebuilt, whether it's converted to bike and pedestrian use, or whether it is abandoned entirely, there are things that can happen on that county jurisdiction roadway that will help to improve that point in Squaw Creek and downstream. And those include, as Dick mentioned, flood control, installing greater flood storage capacity, putting in some natural type stream structures that would enhance the natural stream functions, slowing down the water for one, and other sorts of practices. So in looking at the entire watershed, of course, the focus is on what's happening in this stretch of Squaw Creek. We're seeing a lot of erosion laterally, especially in one meander, that's taking out some pretty nice land. Further downstream, we see that the stream has moved against the bluff and is slowly cutting the bluff bank down and threatens a residential home there. And there are a number of other lesser problems as well. There is erosion elsewhere on the stream in this stretch. And so our practices would help alleviate much of that stress along that section of the stream. And they would be appropriate practices for the scale of water flow and the types of floods that can come through there. Dick has said that about every 10 years or more often, that entire bottom area is covered in 2 to 4 feet of water. So we're looking at a 10-year flood interval, if not slightly more often than that. And that's confirmed by the Iowa Flood Center's mapping system as well. So their calculations, their measurements, their field surveys indicate that this is about a 10% chance of a flood every 10 years. That's sending a lot of water downstream, which affects the city of Ames pretty directly. So the sorts of practices we're talking about putting in would have tremendous downstream benefits as well, not just on the stretch of stream that we'd be working in. And as I said, we emphasize a whole watershed approach. Let me tell you a little bit about our process that we go through. And when we get into the field, our initial point of entry is with a landowner such as Dick and Dave, who have a recognized problem and want to do something about it. And so we discuss with them what their perception of the need is and what they'd like done, and then we offer our skill set and our understanding of what's happening. And I used to be a college teacher, by the way, so I have the tendency to face the larger audience. The audience is really up front here. I realize that. So then we do an initial assessment of the stream section in question to figure out what the possibilities are. And at that point, we move to paid work, which is a full stream survey. And that includes determining the vertical elevations with a laser survey in the field of various stream features so that we can calculate those as precisely as possible. We want to know two things. We want to know the speed of the water moving past certain points in our site, and we want to know the discharge rate, the amount of water coming through at different flood stages, which can all be calculated from one survey. We moved to permit applications. To do any stream modification, it requires permitting from at least the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers and probably a joint permit with the Corps and with the DNR.
And maybe even the county floodplain.
And that would be a further component of it, too. And then we hope to move into the construction phase. So let me comment on our stream practices very briefly, that these are tried and true practices. As long as you get the surveying part right, so there's a big emphasis on that, the practices that we have are tried and true in the Midwest and have been researched and studied for about 70 years now, going back to the late 1940s. There have been engineers working on this, and there have been ecologists and a number of other people working on it. After construction is done, it's very important to monitor what's happened and make sure that it's functioning correctly, tweak it here and there as necessary, and then keep up that monitoring to make sure that this is going to have a substantial lifetime. We are not into five-year fixes or even 10-year fixes. We hope to make changes that will alter a stream positively for several decades, if not longer, to help the stream do what it wants to do, to let the water do the work rather than us do all the work. So that's a general introduction to what we would do at this particular site, starting with the bridge. And thank you for hearing us today. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, we're so excited you're here. I mean, it's a real serendipity that this showed up on the agenda same day that we're talking about ultimately what's going to happen with the 190th Street bridge right there on Squaw Creek. A couple things that I would just note. Make sure, I would just encourage you guys, while you're talking about one section of the overall stream, and I know you look at the holistic approach of the entire stream, work with Prairie Rivers really closely on this. They, in fact, have done a full assessment of the entire stretch of Squaw Creek and all the tributaries. And then I want to say this about Story County. So Story County, the two seated on either side of me, but even before the three of us are seated together, has been a leader in this ongoing recommitment, I should say, to water quality. Story County is in the process of doing a full watershed assessment countywide. We will be the first county in the state of Iowa to have done a complete watershed assessment on all of our watersheds in Story County. We now have two watershed authorities established. Squaw Creek was our first one that was established, and then just in the last couple of months, we've established what's known as the Kegley Branch, which is a branch that comes off of the Skunk River and runs to the northeast. So we've got those two established. It will be very interesting to see what happens once we get the full assessment of our entire watershed. But I believe that the intent, I think it's fair for me to say, that the intent is that's a starting point for how Story County is going to start to do our part to address some of the water quality issues. And let's just be really clear on this. It would have to be, as we're talking about here, some kind of public-private partnership where it takes private landowners stepping up and putting forth the resources and the commitment to do what's required on their land, but it also takes a public commitment to make sure that we're not trying to do things on an island, that is part of a greater whole as we look at the entire stretch there along Squaw Creek. Laura, Sparty, anything to add or any questions?
I would suspect, Luke, you had something you wanted to say. You were holding up a panel of pictures. Is there anything else you want to close with?
Sure, yeah. What's fascinating to me is, I see this a lot, private landowners are stewards of public resources, whether it's migratory birds that fly from Argentina to Canada every year and stop along the way to get some berries in the spring. There are stewards of our water supplies and our recreation opportunities. This stream, Squaw Creek, is used by all kinds of kids running around, swimming in it, looking for fish, and it's a really special public resource. I haven't seen yet in our county a really innovative kind of approach like this, working just like what you said, and I think this is the right landowner to work for, to work with. I would love to know, you know, what our next steps might be to collaborate with you all, and maybe we could have some signage, maybe we could have an event to help the community learn about.
So Prairie Rivers has already produced signage identifying the Squaw Creek watershed, and I happen to, where I live in Ames, I have Clear Creek running through my backyard, which is part of the Squaw Creek watershed, right? Clear Creek runs down and ultimately ties in at Meeker Golf Course. But so I have one of the signs on my property. It'd be worth looking at that signage. Second thing I would say is, this is, while it doesn't impact Squaw Creek directly, the work the county is currently undertaking at the research park. For those of you that don't know, there's a 34-acre piece of ground that the county owns as part of the research park. It includes the stream that runs through the research park, and the county is going in, the county conservation is going in and putting in, Mike, is it too strong to say state-of-the-art and cutting-edge watershed practices? And I'm looking at Mike Cox, our director of conservation, that I, again, part of this holistic approach that is Story County, I think the work that's being done in that stretch could be instructive in some of the things that we're going to talk about in Squaw Creek. Fair to say?
I would say stabilization practices.
Okay.
Yeah, so our practices that I was holding up, and I can send more information, would be really innovative. Re-meanders, where we have a stream that's been straightened over the course of the last 100 years, and we strategically find a way to bring back those meanders into that straightened section to increase the length of the stream, to increase the diversity of habitat for aquatic life to procreate, and in this case also to protect structure. Mm-hmm. So there's really cool ways where I don't see a lot of these practices in Iowa, where I'm seeing them in Missouri, in Minnesota, and up the coast, in Ohio. The funding structures are not there yet.
Right.
Prayers said, boy, we love these ideas. We encourage you, you know, once you have a good success, come back to us, and we'll, you know, we can't touch something that's so new and different. And
sure.
And I thought maybe the county, maybe with this bridge challenge, maybe we can find a small project to start.
Yeah, so it sounds to me like you're talking to exactly who you need to be talking with, Darren Moon, when it deals with any of our areas where roadways cross streams. But then I would encourage you, if you don't know Mike Cox in the back, if you know Mike Cox, Director of Conservation, I know our Conservation Board is highly committed to all things involving water quality. I'll finally say this. The reality is, in Iowa, not just in Iowa, but we're talking about in Iowa right now. In Iowa, for the last 120 years, the way water was viewed is get it off the farmland and downstream as fast as possible, right? We're trying to grow crops, and so all of our state laws, all of our practices, everything for the last 120 years has been about water comes on the ground and let's get it downstream as fast as we can. And we never worried about what was in it, what it was doing to our soil. We never worried about any of that. That has really changed fairly. It's changed over the last 20 or 30 years, but fairly dramatically over the last half dozen years or so. The way we talk about it, the way we think about it has changed. And like I said, we're at the very beginning of a long, long journey. But we just got to get started, and I'm grateful to you guys for helping get us started on that conversation.
Okay. Laura? Yes. Lee, you had talked about options on the bridge, but I didn't hear you talk about the option of if we pulled the bridge out. Would that greatly affect your project, this plan, how you look at this project? Does it rely upon the bridge remaining?
Well, there are two ways of looking at it, and one is keeping the bridge in place for whatever purpose. So taking the bridge out entirely does make some changes in what would be done at that point in the right-of-way, but not a great amount of difference. Either way, there are things that can be done at that point that will help the stream there and downstream as far as preservation of the land on either side, maintaining vehicle access on either side, and so forth. Mainly preventing erosion and mainly providing flood storage and slowing the stream down a bit.
And Would the flood storage impact people then on the north side of the bridge? I mean, if let's say that this whole project was implemented through, would that impact people on the north side?
The flood storage consists of creating low-level, flat areas for the stream to move into, and that actually relieves the pressure, you might call it, up on the stream terrace where people are farming and living.
I'm intrigued. So, go for it. Yeah.
You're talking about the low-level storage. Would that be north or south of the 190 bridge? We live northwest of the bridge.
Okay. It could be on either side, and the way that this is designed and carried out, it's not a threat to anybody's home. In fact, we look at the infrastructure along the stream very carefully to make sure that our practices are not going to cause harm to the homes, backyards, or anything of that sort.
And in fact, state law as it currently exists will not allow any sequestration of water on somebody else's property without their permission. So we have to follow it through. And ma'am, would you introduce yourself so that we know who asked the question?
I'm Ann Trapper.
Yeah.
My husband Tom is here. And we do live just north of the bridge on the west. That is our floodplain. You can see our driveway coming up. So it does not impact our house, but it impacts us.
And I'm sure that the people from Prairie, Kayla Hasper, has been out to see you guys.
When I did the burn a few years ago, I met the neighbors. They were going to do their burn that week.
So I want to thank you.
We're doing private at some time to talk over your concerns and our approach.
Yeah, I see everything going south of the bridge. I'm interested in.
Okay.
So what I'd like to do anyway is have a meeting with Gary privately just to ask more questions, because I know we've got a lot on the agenda today.
Absolutely.
So, but anyway.
Rubber boots. Let's go look at that screen.
Absolutely. Yeah, thank you very much.
Rubber boots. Okay.
Probably what my job's like.
All right.
Thank you, guys.
Now the old PA guy in me wants to say, and now for the main event. We're going to pull from item 15, we're going to pull items 1 and 2 up to discuss now and just continue on Squaw Creek. So Darren, come on up. Our first item is discussion of options to permanently close the Squaw Creek Bridge on West 190th Street in Section 17 of Franklin Township. So I'll try to tee this one up, Darren, and then we'll go. Several years ago, so the in Story County, there's 282 bridges, depending on how long a bridge is. And from 1990 through 2010, due to budget concerns and some other things, Story County replaced 26 bridges in that 20-year period, 1.3 per year, which means it would take you somewhere in the neighborhood of 210 years to replace all your bridges in Story County. Bridges don't last 210 years. So we really started digging into it. Darren Moon and the previous board of supervisors really started digging into it about 2010 or 2011 and started to try to figure out, okay, how can we get down a sustainable pathway for our roads and bridges in Story County? And in fact, we have done that. We will have done somewhere in the neighborhood of 38 bridges in the last 7 years at the end of this construction season, which in fact lets us get through all our bridges on average in 50 years instead of 210. But part of that conversation was Darren was charged with, at that time, and again, I think it's 2010 or 11, Darren, you can correct me if I'm wrong, but Darren was charged with, take a look at our bridges that are most expensive to replace for multiple reasons and that have the least amount of traffic with the least amount of impact if the bridge didn't exist in terms of rerouting people around. This was one of the bridges that Darren came back with at that time and said, this is a conversation. The bridge is fine right now, but this is a conversation we're going to need to have. We need to hold on to this bridge at least until we replace a smaller bridge on 190th further to the east, which in fact is getting replaced as we speak, so that we can have multiple access points for the people specifically that live north of 190th and east of Squaw Creek so that they have reasonable access in and out. So, in fact, we did that about 2013 or 14. The Cameron States Development started to come out of the ground. That was Friedrich was the developer there. And in our very first conversation with Kurt Friedrich, we identified to him this development may, you know, we can sure talk about this development, but you need to be aware that this long bridge on Squaw Creek is slated for discussion to close. So all the way back at that point. And the reality with this bridge is if it was just as simple as going in and replacing it as it stands, you know, it'd be a big, bigger deal, one of our larger bridges, but it wouldn't be the biggest deal. The problem is changes in regulations for how we cross water would mandate that we build everything up higher in order to alleviate some of the flood concerns, and this bridge becomes multi-million dollar kind of bridge with limited use and a very strong access a half mile to the south on Cameron School Road. So we moved ahead through this process, and I think every time we talk about 190th in the last 4 or 5 years, I've brought this up as this is a conversation we're going to need to have. We're going to need to get to the end of this. This board has heard me talk about that for the last 7 or 8 months, but that's what brings us to today. And the big change is we finally got to the point that letters went out to the local residents and finally made you directly aware of what these conversations are. Darren?
So we take it to you. Lauren, thank you. First of all, this isn't something we do very often, so I want to make the board very aware of who got letters and who didn't, in case you want me to expand that or something, but... this is our bridge right here that we're talking about. We're currently replacing this structure right here. And as part of that, we had a mailing list to warn of the road closure. We kind of used that same mailing list. We had 70 residences, mostly in this area. There's a subdivision here and a lot of houses around it. So as part of this discussion, we notified all of them, all the property owners in this area and over here. We didn't notify Cameron Estates because they were aware of it, and there's a lot of new property owners we have mailing addresses for. And then we notified all over to Prairie Moon Winery, but we did not get down into the Squaw Creek subdivision down here. I did talk to a few of the residents out on site on some of our plans, but they weren't necessarily made aware of this meeting. I know they have some concerns about if we close that, they may get some additional traffic through their it's a public road, but privately maintained on Valley Road there. So let me start with, again, you touched a lot of Rick, but why are we here? Three main reasons, in my opinion. One, this road through here floods quite often. Secondly, the bridge is nearing the end of its useful life. And thirdly, we have some concerns with West 190th on safety concerns. When it was paved, I think that was in about 2001, it was a research project. We did a foot reclaim of the base and then just seal coated it. Normally when we pave a road, we bring it up to a paving standard. Because it was a research project, we did not do that. So safety-wise, it wasn't designed as a collector road. So when Cameron Estates came in, that's when we started looking at, boy, do we want this to be a collector road or not for safety reasons. So I'll get into that a little bit more. First, I want to point out this is the FEMA floodplain map. Our bridge is right here, the little triangle, and this is our other bridge we're replacing now. The reason they're two different colors is that lighter blue is a detailed study area, so they have a real detailed study, which makes it more difficult for us to do a bridge design because we cannot really impact that study design. This is just a general study. In Story County, generally, we try not to back up any more additional water than what's shown here. But the main thing to point out is the width. Usually the floodplain narrows down towards the bridge and goes through the bridge. But here we have a 1,000-foot width, but this is a 100-year storm event. Impacts 1,000 feet of roadway, which makes the design of that bridge a little more difficult. Like I mentioned, the flood concerns on this, it flooded in 2008, 2010, 2013, 2015, and that's what kind of started in my mind. Do we want to keep repairing this road, or is it something we should think about closing down? This is looking back to the east. This is looking to the west. This is after one of the storm events, and it washed
almost all the gravel off the road, and it washes it into the ditch. Say we repaired that. It seemed like about every other year for the past 10 years. Picture when the water was just about down, so you can see where the actual low area is. The bridge is behind me. And then a picture when the water was still going over. I wanted to point out, water does get higher than that. You can see there's a huge tree stump in the middle of the longer bridge we're talking about, so we know water was up over that bridge at least. And then in 2015, we had the event out there where we had a young woman,
motorist, yeah,
come out about 2 o'clock in the morning, went right when that water got over the road and washed her off the road. You can barely see the vehicle out in the middle of that field, so we were out there rescuing her at 3 o'clock in the morning. So that raised concern again. Should we even keep this stretch of road open for safety reasons? Picture of the debris when it gets high. When we start talking about what condition this bridge is in, I'll get into a little bit of the bridge inspection report we just received, but my biggest concern right now is if we get a big rain event and the debris that builds up on the bridge, that really puts a lot of forces on these older wood bridges that length. So that'd be my biggest concern right now. I'd point out, this is the Hickory Grove Bridge. This 3-4 years ago, we lost it. Same issue. We had buildup of debris on it, and it actually took the bridge completely out. And just north of that one was a similar size bridge. You can see the amount of debris that gets caught on there. And this goes back to the strategic plan Rick was talking about. This was the first bridge, and part of that plan we addressed where we actually closed this bridge 2 years ago. We just determined it didn't get enough traffic. We're talking $1 million bridge here, so we decided just to close this one permanently, and so that's already been done. But it's a very similar bridge to this one back. So back to Squaw Creek. This is a meeting we had out here with Luke's group a few weeks ago. We were looking at the bridge and walking the stream. I just wanted to point out, as far as the floodplain goes, there was some erosion on the upstream side here, but it had been protected with some riprap. But behind there is probably my biggest concern right now, some repairs that do need to be made. It's eroded out some of the stream slope, the embankment slope back here, so we probably need to protect that with some riprap if we decide to keep this structure open. Also, we inspect all of our bridges every other year, so every 2 years we get this report. It did kind of show more deterioration in this recent report we just got. There's some piling issues. The third pile from the south is 75% effective, more 75% effective piling. But then the bigger concern is the third pile in the east pier is only 50% effective, and this is a critical part of this. The bridge was actually widened in 1974, I believe it was. That's one we're going to have to address fairly soon. We can probably do that repair in-house if we decide to keep this bridge open. But like I say, even with these repairs, we're probably only looking at a 10, maybe 15-year lifespan before it has to be completely replaced. But we did put $20,000 in repairs in 2001 on this. And it's actually both these, the abutment and the pier, that are having issues now, so that repair only lasted just 17, 18 years.
And Darren, let me just stop right there and ask this question. So you say we could get 10 or 15 years. If we put some dollars into the debris, we could get 10 or 15 years, but that doesn't count the possibility of the debris buildup in a heavy water situation, right? I mean, we're to the point now where a lot of water, a lot of debris could take this bridge out at any point.
Yeah. Yeah. Couple more pictures under the bridge. This is the third pile they were talking about, the most biggest concern. You can't see the other side, but you can see we did repairs 17 years ago because some were in really bad shape. That's why you see ones next to each other, because it was repaired. The other abutment, they're concerned about this pile, so we may have to do some repairs on that as well. And these are protection planks that used to go all the way down at one point, and they got ripped off. But that's kind of a catch-22. If we cover all that up when the bridge inspectors come out, they can no longer see the condition of the pile, so they automatically will rate it very low if they can't see it, and we can't really rip them off every time we come down and inspect that bridge. So But if we do decide to keep it open, that's more repairs will have to be. Moving on, I wanted to address a little bit about the design. I'll go back to this picture here. Again, I talked about it being in the floodplain in a detailed study area. That means we cannot back up any more water than the existing condition does right now. There's also a requirement from the DNR, because it's over 100 square mile drainage area, that we have, there's a low structure elevation, that's the bottom of the bridge beams. We have to have freeboard, which is a 3-foot distance between the bottom of the bridge beam and where the 50-year storm event rises to. So in order to meet the freeboard requirement, you have to raise the bridge up. And so both those rules kind of contradict each other. We raise it up, but yet we can't back up any more water. By raising the bridge up, we have to raise up the approach grade to it, and that's going to back up more water. So it has to get pretty far into the design of this to determine how long that bridge would really need to be and if we could even meet the requirements here. So that's...
Right, but at a minimum, substantially longer than the existing bridge.
Downstream is Cannon School Road. That's a 201-foot long bridge. Upstream, 180th, is a 163-foot, I believe, bridge. So this would be somewhere in the middle of that, probably. And we just did Hickory Grove. That was a 150-foot bridge 2 years ago. That was 800,000. So but a minimum of a million. It could be considerably more, depending on how long this needs to be.
What are your ranges? If you say, okay, you know, the Hickory Grove bridge was 800,000 2 years ago, and you talked about how much wider the bridge would have to be to replace this new, can you give me a sense of the range of dollars it would take from where you would guess to the high end?
That's where it gets tough, because you have to balance how far you raise this grade, and then all that water has to be put through this bridge, so the bridge has to be big enough opening to fit that extra water you're blocking. So I can't tell you how long that bridge would end up being without going through the full detailed design. Now I'm saying 1 to 2 million, but if that design could make that bridge even longer, so it could be more than that. But
yeah, so I've been working off the minimum, absolute minimum. Everything fell exactly right. It's $1 million. And realistically, what we've seen from other bridges that we've tried to do, more like triple that, is where we end up being. So somewhere in that $1 to $3 million range, I think, is a reasonable estimate. I think you would be pretty secure that that's where we end up.
Wow. Thank you. Okay, moving on. Talked about the existing condition of the bridge. Now we're back to concerns about the area in general. We already talked about Cameron Estates going in down here. So that raised some concerns about the safety of this being a collector road. Cameron Estates abuts Cameron School Road, so it's not really out of the way from all of this subdivision to take Cameron School Road and over if they're heading up north towards Gilbert or something. So it's not really all that necessary for that to be around.
And I think it's important that we mention right here that we've got an intersection problem, an intersection issue that's only going to get worse, regardless of what we do here at Cameron School Road and George Washington Harbor. It's something that this board and Darren have talked about regularly. We, in fact, have started discussions with the City of Ames at what is going to happen with the intersection of Cameron School Road and George McCarver. I think it's very safe to say that you're going to see an enhanced intersection in one way or another there at Cameron School Road.
So we have the two major subdivisions here, and I don't see a need for this subdivision to use that road. This subdivision is concerned if we close this again, that traffic, instead of going around this way or going up to R38, will try to use that private road, which they currently have speed bumps in there, which
pretty substantial speed bumps.
Yeah, you have to almost come to a stop. So I avoid that road at all costs.
Yeah, I think that's the intent.
Yeah,
I think they don't want us on that
road. I don't know how much. I think they probably would see a little bit more traffic. It's hard to estimate how much would actually go through there.
I've got a friend that lives in the southern part of Squaw Valley, and we were at Alluvial, and decided to go to their house. And instead of going through the most direct route, I went around to George Washington Carver.
Zooming up a little bit more, just to get into, we'll get to the, we have a lot of letters from individuals that had concerns, and the one letter I wanted to point out is from, well, Tom Cackler kind of started looking at all the people that live on the gravel portion, so they had a little meeting with six residents, I believe, that probably includes all of these here. And they were in favor of closure with some, they'd like to take into consideration some of their concerns, so I'll get to those in their letter. I wanted to point out where they live. Moving on to traffic counts. This is the bridge right here. Right now, this is the 2015 counts. The DOT counts these every 4 years. They show 80 vehicles a day here. I would estimate about half of that being just from the local residents that live on the gravel portion, probably generate 30 to 40 vehicles a day. So the rest of that's probably coming from the subdivision up here going this direction instead of going around that way. Show 580 on the paved portion of West 190th, and the 60s after the paved portion drops off just north of the subdivision, so the 585 wraps around considerably. So that's what we're looking for traffic counts. So we'd probably be impacting, my guess is about those 40 vehicles a day. That'd probably take a different route. Those are the main things I wanted to point out on this. That probably leads us to some of the public comments. This isn't a public hearing item, so we're not open to hearing, but we can read these comments into the record.
Yeah, we're going to hear from anybody who wants to talk to us. And the main thing for me, Darren, is while I don't know that it's necessary that we read every one of the emails or letters that we've received into the record, we do need to make sure that we're addressing every one of the concerns in every one of these. I think we've done that. A lot of them are questioning why this wasn't part of the county's plan, and why are we just hearing about this now? And hopefully we've addressed that it has, in fact, been part of the county's plan, and you're hearing about it now because that's the point of the process that we're at. Were there other questions that stood out to you as part of this?
I think we addressed the main ones. I'd probably hit on the ones from Tom's letter with some additional requests that they have on what portion we'd actually close and stuff.
And let's let Tom come up and do that, if you're okay with it, sir. Let Tom come up and do that. I'll make one note from the letters I've seen, and Darren, see if you felt the same thing. With a few exceptions, most of what we heard from people who actually live west of the bridge or north of the bridge were fairly positive kind of ideas with, yeah, it makes sense to close this thing. Overwhelmingly heard negative responses from the people who live in Squaw Valley, which is ironic because they never use the bridge. Their concern is the impact to their neighborhood with people pulling down through there. And as we show, we believe it's about 40 vehicles that would have the new opportunity now to use that. I'm one of those that I think with the speed humps approval taking care of that, it's not an easy road to drive, I think, as it was intended. But that was the sense that I got from who I heard from, and I heard from others via text message. I know Doug Moore's in the audience today. He and I have been texting back and forth pretty regularly on this. That was the sense I got. Did you get the same kind of sense?
Yeah, that sounds pretty accurate.
Okay, so with that, we'll start with you, sir, and then we'll open it up to anybody who has anything they want to ask, address, anything you want to say. Yes, sir, come on up. Start by introducing yourself and your address, please.
I'm Tom Cackler, and I live at 4909 West 190th, which is, I guess, the first driveway there as you start going up.
Absolutely.
My neighbors are here. Dean, who lives just to the west, and then Don Draper is just across the street there. So
sure. You
guys may have more to say. does the board have copies of the letter?
We did.
Okay, all right. you know, we when we got the notice, we kind of started talking to each other and with the idea, well, where are we at? Are we on the same page or not? And there's obviously pros and cons when you get into closing a bridge there, but I think it's fair to say that we all support closing the bridge, and we've expressed that in the letter that we gave you. And then there's a couple, 2 points basically that we want you to consider as you do that. The first one is, you know, it's the point of closure. We would ask you to do that as far to the west on as you can to minimize the amount of kind of dead end road down there. There is a I have 2 field entrances on the north side there that I really don't need access to, so don't need to worry about that. And I know there's, I think, one on the south there about midway. I don't know if it'd be a possibility to move that further west, but I guess our thinking is that you know, there certainly has been some dumping. It's signed for that. I know Dean may want to speak to. I mean, it's cars are parking down there at night at times, and you get the beer bottles and that type of thing. So, generally, having a long, stub, dead end road is not a good thing to leave. For, you know, it causes you guys problems and maintenance and all that. So that's, and we outline that in the letter. The other thing is that we would request that you take the bridge out. It's going to continue to deteriorate. It would have to be addressed at some point. There are, I don't know, Dean and Don may want to comment, very, very few bicyclists that would use that if you wanted to. I mean, I can't, in the years I've been there, I mean, maybe a couple of handfuls of bikes, maybe. It's very seldom used. In my experience as bikes, there are a few people that walk along there, but it would seem to me that, you know, just walk a little different route if you want to get some exercise. But I understand the need to, and desire to have access to that property on the south there, that you need to, public access, so you need to consider that. But I think taking the bridge out will help, to me, alleviate problems that you have to deal with downstream with or down in the future with maintenance of the bridge, safety issues. It's just going to continue to deteriorate. It would be our thought that best to have it out, have it cleaned up. It would make the river experience, I think, a little better to have it out of there. So those were our two items we wanted you to consider. And other than that, six of us there along the road would support the closure. So.
Super. Thank you very much.
Darren, just as a point on fuel approaches, that's not a hardship to take those out if they would. So
no, that does raise another point I'd probably point out now. That's probably the south field entrance you see right there to get to this field. Let's say Tom has a couple more in there. The other issue with the actual point of road closure gets the other discussion of flood control. If we vacate the road, that pretty much takes it out of the hands of the county, so the private landowners could do whatever they wanted with the road, including cutting a hole in it, and we have no control over that. So we've had some concerns. I know Scott Renault was one. He just didn't see that road stay in place and kind of hold back water for flood control if it ever actually got washed out in the future. So moving the closure point back, we have to figure out what to do with that road if we wanted to keep it under county control. If it's a county road, you pretty much have to allow public access to it unless you level C it, which we don't have any level C roads, but it's where you put a gate and a lock on it. So that'd be about the only option that we could keep control over this, but yet not have traffic.
And is there any possibility, and maybe this is more of a Jessica Reynolds, County Attorney Jessica Reynolds question, is there any possibility of the county vacating the road but establishing some kind of easement where the structure will be maintained by the private property owners in order to alleviate what you're concerned and others are concerned about, and that is allowing water to move through there even more quickly in high water lines.
Yeah, there's a lot of counties just sell the bridge to private owners for a dollar just to get out of the county's liability. That could be done. But to keep the actual roadway itself in place, you'd probably keep that under county control somehow. But I do agree we probably want to limit the length of the dead end because it would get to
that. Oh, yeah.
Yeah. So I'm ideally using maybe the clicker or how we're doing there. Okay. Where would you like us to close it to the left if we close it?
I guess we'll see if I can point to it. You know, maybe more up in this area so that, you know, you're going to have to have enough room there where, you know, you've got garbage trucks and stuff got to come down and turn around. There may be, who knows, school buses in the future, however that would work out. But somewhere as close as you can and provide, depending what your longer-term plans are for public access, if you know, to have a spot for a few people to park and be able to walk down there, you know, however that would work, it would be fine. But our main concern is just having a long where you can drive down in there more than walking.
Right.
So if you drive down in there and can park and you're 1,000 feet from anybody, why, that's probably not a good thing.
Sure. Well, and so that would be my other question, Darren, and we've got Mike Cox here. Is this a possibility where we could come up almost to Tom's driveway right there and close it down, but put a small parking area, a place where our motor grader can turn around, a place where dump trucks and things like that can turn around, and then make the remainder of that moving to the east, a county trail with access down to the stream, which would then keep it under county control. We would be able to maintain it at the level we wanted to maintain it, but it would be a walking path. Is that a possibility, as you see it?
I think it would. It have to be agreeable to adjacent property owners because we haven't just an easement for that road at this purpose.
Okay.
For road purposes, this would be changing the use of that, so we probably have to get an easement or purpose.
Are you talking about a level C or a level B at that point?
I'm talking about not a road. I'm talking about more like a natural trail is what I'm talking about. Maintained by conservation.
Sure. Probably have to get some sort of easement writing from the adjacent property owners. We vacate the road and yet go back and purchase an easement over for trail purposes.
Yeah. Thank you, sir.
Yeah. Would that be the smallest trail in Iowa, Mike?
Well, again, that goes back to the conversation of if you stop vehicular traffic, are you going to look at this as pedestrian access to the stream? And I understand you guys' feelings that, and in many ways I agree with it, it's easier to take the bridge out. I don't know what the laws say in terms of if the county were ever to put a pedestrian bridge. Mike, if you were to put just a pedestrian bridge across it, you have to follow the same flood guidelines that a roadway would have to, which we'd end up with the same issue that we got now. Yeah. Yes, sir.
Thank you, Mike.
All right. Come up so that we'll get you on tape. Hey, boy, that just betrayed my youth in the 70s.
I would have said the same thing.
Yeah.
Again, Dick Van Dusen. Well, actually, Natural Heritage Foundation now owns it, but this is part of the farm that we donated. And the entrance is right here. It could be moved. That's not a big issue by itself. But part of what we have talked about with the Heritage Foundation is the ultimate use of this land and the land down here. If that land becomes greenway of some sort, either for the county or if the city comes out that far, the city, and who knows what development might happen upstream. One of the potential uses is for a bike path that continues all the way down,
sure,
ultimately to Brookside Park. And one of the things we talked about is if the bridge is maintained as a pedestrian bike path, then we can get across and a path could be developed further upstream. So long-term view of how that area is going to be made accessible to the public, because it will eventually become public access land, I think is something that needs to be considered. If you end the road here, I could see, for instance, taking that whole silly road out, as we saw in that one picture where the floodwater crosses up here and is trying to cut a path across here.
Right.
Now, I don't know, Luke, if that would be a remeander, which would be an advantage or a disadvantage. These are things that really need to be talked about and thought through seriously for the long term, because that that restored prairie CRP land would then become stream bed. That's okay, too. So we really need to be paying attention to all of the things that can potentially happen in here. And I'm open to discussing any and all of them. I'm not locked in on one way of solving this, but I think we have to be very thoughtful as we go forward.
My mind just got blown by what Dick just said, because what's really fun about nature and restoration is it all starts with a landowner objective. So this whole process over the last year, working with Dick and Dave and INHF, we've really tried to focus on their objectives. But to come to this meeting and hear that your objectives are to, you know, road closure, what if we could work across property boundary landowners with a neighbor to the north, and what if we could work with the county's vision for this site? And yeah, like where that stream's located right now, it's just where it is because of all the tile we put in, you know, and pushed it all the way over to the edge of that bluff. But if we had a vision of this floodplain for a stable community, they didn't just try to hold floods back with a road, but held floods in a healthy stream channel. That is how we can protect Squaw Creek downstream from flooding out all the big box stores. You know, if we had this approach countywide, I mean, I just feel like this is a really exciting development, and to think you've got a known entity with the INHF property, always going to be prairie, and now we have a known entity potentially with what this road is always going to be, now we can start doing really innovative things.
Mm-hmm. Super. Thanks, Luke. Yes, sir. Oh, I'm sorry. What was the question before we get away?
Actually, for Mike Cox, again, because I see he's back there. But Mike, is this area somewhere that's on your trails plan so far, or has it been anticipated at all?
That's a good 25-year question
right
there. Yeah, right. Yeah. Okay. So, yeah, we did a trails plan as part of the C2C.
Right. Mike, introduce yourself or anybody who doesn't.
Yeah, I'm Mike Cox. I'm the conservation director here at Story County. We did do a trails plan as part of the C2C. We integrated a previous document called the Greenways Plan into that trails plan. And that did call for a kind of a greenway trail along the Squaw. So that really is a concept. It really hasn't gone beyond that concept at the moment, but yeah, there is potential. You know, I agree with a lot of what has been commented. There is some good potential for not only flood mitigation, resource management, but also for public access at this portion as well. So commend Luke and for working with INHF on this project.
And also important to note that Mike Cox is also a board member of Prairie Rivers of Iowa, who is putting together, or has put together, kind of a master plan for this entire Squaw Creek Watershed Authority.
Thank you. Thanks for being here.
Mr. Draper, I believe?
Yes.
I'm Don Draper. I've lived along this area here for 41 years, and I've seen all the floods that Darren's talked about and have experienced them. And I guess I signed a letter with our neighbors, and I'm still in agreement with that. And I applaud the things that I've heard here, because I can remember catching largemouth bass in that stream, and they're not there anymore. I can remember catching walleyes, believe it or not, in that stream, and they're no longer there. So there's it's loaded with wildlife, all kinds of wildlife, so your things you're talking about could be restored and enhanced. I have a technical question to ask Darren, is that when you close roads, what kind of a barrier do you put up? And the reason I'm asking that is that you just described to us earlier a situation in which you were working with stop signs and people ignored it and ran right through it. And immediately to the east of me, where you're working on the bridge right now, you have barriers up there. And guess what? I pull up there three times now and hear people that have gone onto the barriers right down to where they're starting to work, and they have to turn around. So I want something, if we're going to close it, which I hope you do, if you're going to put a barrier in there, I want to know what you put in.
Sure. I sort of picture that bridge that we closed a couple years ago over on 248. What we do is, the standard closure for that is it's about 4 to 5 signs driven into the road itself, and they have all kinds of reflectors on them. They're smaller signs, but there's a number of them across the road, and they're permanently put into the ground. So you can walk between them, but you couldn't drive like a four-wheeler or something through there.
Good. Thank you.
The other thing I'll note is we saw the picture of the young woman's car who was out in the middle of the field. We had put up the road closed signs. This was during a flood event. We had put up the road closed signs, and she just ignored them, which is a very real issue that we get into, where people think the road closed signs don't apply to them.
But that one, we actually weren't out there before she did it, and that was some of the concern. Because happened at 2 in the morning, and it really wasn't predicted to come quite that high. So that's what we had discussion after that, that we're anywhere close to getting that high, we're going to go out the night before and put them up.
Well, I feel better about her. I thought she had driven around one of our road closed signs.
No, but she did admit she saw the water before she went into it. She just made the decision to go through it anyway.
And I lived right next to it, and I got to hear her cry and scream and yell.
Who else would like to address us this morning? We'll start in the front, work our way right back. Start by introducing yourself and your address, please.
Sure. My name is Dean Girard. I live at 4957 West 190th, which is this little spot right here. I am fully in favor of closing this bridge. Can I use some of these pictures here?
Yeah.
I'd like to go back to
Okay.
So this is my house that you see right here, and my driveway. You can see my garbage can here. So my driveway is directly in the middle of this hill, and it is definitely the most dangerous driveway on that stretch. So from the top of the hill and the bottom of the hill, there's what people don't realize, I guess, is when you're coming from the west, you can see pretty much most of this flat land here in the bridge. And so people will, as they approach, they see there's no cars coming, they maintain speed. I've seen upwards of 60 miles an hour over that hill. On the same issue from coming from the east, people, they come down, they see if there's cars coming opposite way. As they get to the bottom of the hill, they don't see anything. Prior to that, they barrel up over the hill as well. My garbage man comes every Tuesday, and in the last year alone, I spoke with him this past spring, I guess, and he said that his truck had been hit or bumped during the past year 3 times by a vehicle coming from the westbound, because garbage truck parked right there is completely blind, and the garbage truck, as you know, is about 14 feet tall, something like that. So, I'm definitely in favor of closing, specifically for traffic reasons. Number two, I don't really have a preference of whether or not the bridge is ripped out, but having it closed off as far to the west as possible is definitely a priority, because As you can see, my house views out over that road, and I've been there for almost 8 years now, and I've seen things that I can't even say in public forum. You know, cars bouncing up and down, and people doing drugs, and illegal dumping, and just lots of tomfoolery stuff with dirt bikes or whatever the case may be, and disrespect to my neighbor's property. And so seeing this closed would be a great asset as far as safety. In the 8 years, I've seen this road flood 4 times, I believe. It might be 5. But as far as the flooding goes, I can give you guys some oversight here that when this does flood, the water raises up and raises up, but it actually creeps over the bank up here to the north and fills this entire field before it has to jump over this road here. So as this field fills, it looks like, oh, well, the water's just high, whatever, and it's safe. But once that water actually crests that road, I've seen it go from just a trickle to 2 feet of water in less than 2 hours. And I do recall when that car got washed off the road. There's been twice in the last 8 years where I've called the county and said, you guys need to close this road in the next 2 hours because it will be underwater because I've seen it come up that fast. So as far as removing the road, this is all outside of my knowledge as far as science and ecology and environmental protections and stuff. But, you know, I think that it creates a good natural barrier as far as water backup. And a lot of it is probably due to debris that puts up against that bridge during flooding. So it does slow down. I don't think that it would ever create a specific channel of any sort. If it would have, I think that Tom Cackler would probably already have some of that impact in his property there in that field, and we haven't seen that. It really just becomes a big lake. The big flood we had, was that 2013 or... I forget which one the biggest one was, but a friend of mine and I, we actually got kayaks out when that was at its crest, and we kayaked through his stable with his horses, like literally over the electric fences. So the water has gotten ridiculously high there, and that's obviously a culmination of many, many factors, development, that sort of thing. The last thing I want to speak on is I came to the zoning meeting when they... Friedrich started doing this development, and I was very adamant about, you know, maintaining it as agriculture and not putting the development in, and traffic was my biggest concern. And as you guys mentioned, that it was 80 cars per day in 2015, I believe, when they took that survey. It is not unusual for me to see 80 cars before noon now. And the priority or the primary reason is that when people go across Cameron School Road and they get out to George Washington Carver in the mornings, there is a huge backup because people come from Boone and they take 190 all the way across to get into Ames. So turning left onto George Washington Carver, it backs up the traffic. A lot of people shoot up and they just bypass because then they get to a stop sign and they can go straight across to continue on to 190th. So since this other bridge structure has closed here and they're working on that, the traffic now has gone down dramatically to where there's usually only one or two vehicles that I see that are regularly disregarding speeds and people's safety, basically, which has been really nice. You know, they put down dust control over that whole road in anticipation of this project, and it's now like concrete. It doesn't take long for that. And so the speeds of the few vehicles that are going through there is a much higher speed rate. And, you know, my biggest priority is obviously safety. I have a 5-year-old daughter, myself included. I've been almost hit 3 times pulling out of my driveway, and my mailbox has been taken out on 2 occasions in the last 8 years from people losing control coming over that hill. As far as water conservation goes, you know, all of my neighbors, we all want to do as much as possible to maintain it and make it a natural area. But to see it become, you know, like if there was a parking lot down there, I mean, you got to do what you got to do if it's going to become public access, I guess. But with some of the stuff that I've seen, the farther west we can close it, I guess, is definitely the best case scenario I see maybe two or three people that use it as a walk or a running area every day. Rarely do I see a bicycle unless it's some kids from the Squaw Creek subdivision, that sort of thing. And I think primarily most of the residents in this new development, Cameron Estates, are not using it as a bypass. So that's a good thing. I think most of it is actually traffic that is not in the area. It's people that are coming from the Boone area, from Town Line Road, that sort of thing. So, all of our neighbors, we spoke about it, and we're all in agreement, and we hope to see that this is a pretty easy decision, that it does get closed for several reasons. And then, however, it can help the watershed in the future, we're all for that, too. So I think that's all I have to say on that.
Perfect. Thank you.
Thank you.
Yes, sir. I saw Doug Morton, actually, then I'll come back to you. Doug, come on up. Start by introducing yourself and your address, Doug.
Gotcha.
Doug and I have a long text string going back and forth on this issue.
Traffic on screen. So my name is Doug Moore. I live at 3938 Squaw Road, which is a offshoot of Valley Road. So it seems that yesterday, I think I texted Rick at 3 p.m. On social media, this turned into the cause of the day. And it was interesting to see that most of the people that were commenting in the negative way all live in Cameron Estates. And I would agree. Sorry, what was your name, sir?
Dean.
I would agree with everything Dean said about the safety of 190th Street. So we go to Alluvial daily, many times a day, sometimes, and I have two kids.
But you're not driving.
Never. I'm always walking, sometimes walking my bicycle. But I would agree that 190th, and I think Darren mentioned that was an experimental road, and it's funny, I've even mentioned it to Jeff Taylor, that I think that's the only, what I would call tar and chip from Pennsylvania. That's what we called it. That's the only road I've seen in the county that's tar and chip. And it's definitely not made for the kind of speeds that people are going across it on. I keep waiting for somebody to end up on the area that I call Turtle Island, which is right across that marshy area right south of the Alluvial driveway. And there's an island in there full of turtles, if you guys have seen it. It's kind of neat. But the amount of traffic and the speeds are just nuts. So this morning I called Darren because I didn't know if I could make it to the meeting. And if I'm understanding it right, I hate these pointers. So if I'm understanding it right, Darren, so we have 580 cars from GWC over to the gravel. Right?
Right?
But then we drop down to 80. So I would say that means to me the majority of this 580 are headed into Squaw Valley, right? That's really going Squaw Valley or north, right? Mm-hmm. So if we got 80 cars that are headed on the gravel, to me, the Squaw Valley argument is specious. I don't think it's going to be that big of a deal. As Rick mentioned, as Darren mentioned, anybody in here who's driven down Valley Road who doesn't live in Squaw Valley, don't come. We don't want you there. That's why the speed bumps are there. I don't see 40 people coming down Valley Road. And I got to tell you, if there's 100 people, maybe we make the speed bump bigger. We put in 5 more. I asked Darren this morning, if I understand the way the law reads, we could put up a gate if we wanted to, as long as we could make emergency access. And I'm not saying we're gonna. I'm just saying that I think objections from Squaw Valley in this case are A, premature, and B, fixable if there is a problem. So that's the first part of my comments. So you're getting my mission that I am all for this. The second is, I think there's a lot of positives to this unrelated to traffic. Anybody who's been to Alluvial or Prairie Moon in the past year, that is becoming a tourist destination, and it's bringing people from out of town into Story County. There's a lot of beer tourism that's going around, and nothing against Prairie Moon. I'm just not a wine guy. I don't go over there very much. But I have talked to people that say, we won't ride our bikes up there because that road is dangerous for cyclists. So they stay down in Madrid, and they go on the, whatever that is, the Trestle Trail, and they'll go to the bar down there, but they won't come up to 190th. I have some good friends that are very involved in that group of beer and bike people, and they've just said 190th is too sketchy for a lot of the reasons that Dean said. I won't let my kids ride their bikes on 190th, especially right in that section. I'm always going east to west. You start heading down that road, and it's a death trap. People are flying up to the top of it. So I think for and I don't want to speak for alluvial by any stretch, but I think we are going to see some real advantages if we close that off and put decent signage out on the George Washington Carver side that makes it very clear that, hey, we're open past alluvial, and then you can get bicycles over. Rick and I talked briefly yesterday about a bike path that would head down GWC and maybe connect with Hunziker's new sidewalk, which I call now the sidewalk to nowhere, that's in his new development, which would then connect all the way down. Then you've got a sidewalk path.
We've got them on both sides of George Washington Carver right now. There's one on Northridge Heights as well that's a bike path to nowhere.
Right, and Dean's End a little bit farther north, I think, right now. But you're right, Rick. So, again, I see a lot of positives there. And positives to alluvial, positives to the traffic flow. And, again, I think the misconception may be that the folks that are now moving into Cameron Estates, I'm not sure it was communicated to them that this could happen.
Sure.
And but it's not like they don't have a way to get out. And again, I think Squaw Valley, and I don't want to speak for the entire neighborhood by any stretch, but I will say that I think this is all fixable. If we end up with a traffic increase, I don't see it as a big deal. We don't have that many cars coming down there that don't belong there in the first place now. The speed bumps scare the heck out of people. I'm sorry?
Slow.
Exactly. It's inconvenient and slow. So then my last thing is, I'm sorry, I had two things. I'll make them quick. I believe I look at things in the aggregate, and I did a little bit of math here. Darren, so you said this is going to be a $3 million bridge, give or take, right, if we have to do it. So if we do a bridge lifespan of 50 years, and there's 365 days, so that's 18,250 days over the life of the bridge, and we have 80 cars right now. And because of the nature preserve, that deck, right, that you put in, I don't see that number increasing at all. So that comes out to over 50 years, roughly 1.5 million cars. So we're basically saying we are subsidizing $2 per trip over that bridge. That's insane. For use of public money, which we all know is pretty limited, that's absolutely nuts. So, then a good friend of mine, who he didn't tell me I could use his name, but a property owner in the area, he called me this morning very upset about this and said, well, that's going to destroy all the development possibility east of the existing big bridge, since we have a big bridge, small bridge right there. And I think now, if I understand it better, there is no development possibility there. Everything to the north is big-time floodplain.
Absolutely.
That's never going to change. And everything to the south, you donated to natural heritage, pretty much, right? That's what I thought as well. So, I think that, Darren, you mentioned that Cameron School is the collector road. 190th was never sold to anybody as this is going to be a secondary way to reach a development. Am I correct in that? Okay. So I'm all for it. I think there's a lot of positives.
Thanks.
Yep.
And so let's put the whole $1 to $3 million thing into perspective, and then I know there's several more that want to speak. Your total budget last year was $6.5 million. Total road budget, all of Story County, $6.5 million, and we're talking about $1 to $3 million for one bridge out of 282. Okay? Back in the back was next, and then Lee, I'll come back to you. Start by introducing yourself, please.
Yep, I'm Andrew Murdoch. I live on 510th Avenue, so I might be the first person here for the bridge. Thank you, first of all, for letting us come here today. A lot of good information, learned a lot from you guys, so that's good. I'm a bit unique. I grew up in Squaw Valley. I now live at the entryway to Prairie Ridge, so I kind of have a view of how it affects me today living in Prairie Ridge and how it potentially could have affected me as a kid in Squaw Valley. Now, the numbers from 2015, these right here,
right,
those are interesting. Alluvial didn't open until late 2015.
Right.
So those I don't think are great numbers. I think Doug made a lot of good points. He says he walks or bikes to Alluvial. Some people don't. Some people drive. So Squaw Valley needs to be aware. People that are driving after drinking there aren't going to want to go on the main road. They're going to either want to take the dirt road or Squaw Valley, if that bridge is out at Squaw Valley and all the kids in there. That's just one thing to think about. I know 2 weeks ago, Alluvial served 500 people plus for their barbecue deal. So there are a lot more people. All of those numbers are going to jump. I think what we're hearing also is 190th is a major issue by itself. It's scary. Doug doesn't want his kids out on 190th. I don't want my kids out on 190th.
Right.
However, my kids do want to go somewhere. Squaw Valley's nice. They have the speed bumps, so we need to try to get there. Sometimes we try to go there. That's scary. The dirt road, I know you guys aren't seeing a lot of people. It's because my kids are 7 and under and can't bike that far yet. But we do go down to the bridge. You look over the bridge. It's fun. It's a bit safer. I understand that it is dangerous because I drive that road as well. However, it feels safer to me than a Friday weekend, alluvial open, prairie moon open, than trying to go down that road with all the traffic. I think we're all looking at the $1 to $3 million deal. What we're forgetting is everything is expanding north of Ames right now, right? You've got Cameron States, you've got all these things happening. So I don't know why we're against necessarily keeping it open, and let's see what the next 10 to 15 years bring. And let's do these studies. Let's re-up the numbers. Let's see what's going on. I think we don't want to necessarily take it off the road. I mean, off the ideas. I'm throwing a lot out here because I've been taking a lot of notes. But
sure.
A lot of good stuff, though. Just the alluvial, I already mentioned, Cameron Estates. I noticed that they are starting to build. Some of the houses are starting to punch out of Cameron Estates. Some of the driveways there, the new ones that they're doing. So there will be some people, I think, that, I mean, maybe it is easy for them to go there.
Onto 505th. I think there's four driveways.
Well, and then there's also one popping in, isn't there?
And then there'll be one that comes around on and comes out directly to 190th.
Yeah, and what about the house that they tore down? Is that one going to add a house? I don't know.
Yeah.
Okay. So, I mean, I think things are going to change quick. I mean, I went to Gilbert when it was 1A, and it's now 3A. So things are changing quick. I am a person that uses Squaw Valley when that dirt road's closed because I know the timing. I go to gymnastics in Southwest Ames. I go to the ice rink for figure skating and hockey, and it's either North Dakota or County Line. So when County Line's taken off, I am one of the ones that will use Squaw Valley, and I know the timing. I won't go out to Cameron School. I know that some people that go to it, like you said, you went to Alluvial and you guys went around.
Yeah.
However, when you do something repetitively, you guys all look at the clock, right? Okay. It takes me 10 minutes this route. It takes me 15 that route. But then I've got to get from gymnastics to hockey, and then I've got to get to Gilbert for school, and I've got to do this. So I will be one that's using Squaw Valley. And the numbers will go up. They just will.
Andrew, I have a question for you.
Yep.
We're saying about whether you're going to go over to basically 505th or you're going to go through Squaw Valley. Okay. When you get down to Cameron School Road, then are you taking North Dakota then?
Yep.
Usually? Always on
the
line.
The only time I've got the timing down to a specific. The only time I lose on North Dakota is when there's a train. Then you lose, and then your wife says, "Yeah, I told you this is the wrong way."
Yeah, you should have gone to the road.
Yeah, right. Okay, but thanks for that. That's come up before as a huge traffic count was nowhere to.
The biggest thing I think is just alluvial blowing up is, and I agree, it's going to create a lot more traffic in all directions. But for me, I feel like three exits is better than two.
Yeah, and see, that's where I think I disagree with you because what I hope has been clearly established here is. The 190th to the west is a bad exit, especially if somebody's been drinking. You don't have great sight lines. And I'm not even talking about potentially $3 million to replace that bridge. I'm saying that 190th was never, ever, ever built to have more than 100 cars a day. I'm with you. I think from 2015 to today, we're seeing more traffic over there, and I think it's creating more issues where we see garbage trucks get flipped and things like that. And you mentioned the possibility of development out there. Let's just be really clear. And I'm not suggesting that there's imminent development out in this area. But the places that there could be development in the future happen to be to the west of 505th over to County Line Road. That could develop. And then everything else is south of Cameron School Road. The Iowa State Dairy Farm or whatever farm that is right there is not going to be there permanently. And when that's gone, you're going to see some potential development going on there. Well, none of that I just mentioned has any real business using 505th or 190th.
North and east of Prairie Ridge is also developing. I mean, you guys know because you guys only had grass across from you, and now you have two houses. Two mansions across from you. You have my house built kitty corner to you.
Sure.
And so they're not developed by developers.
Right.
There are houses. And then those people that want to go to Ames or like myself go Southwest Ames are coming. That's where it's getting affected.
Sure. And the other thing that I would point out is very, very clearly, something's got to happen with that intersection at George Washington Carver.
Why not? Yeah.
School,
it's very
has to happen.
Oh, I agree with that.
Which if we can speed up, hopefully slow traffic down and speed up. And so that's code, by the way, for a roundabout. Those of you that hate roundabouts. slow traffic down, but speed up the process of getting through an intersection. If we can do that, it will make it more attractive for the guys like you who look at the watch to say, yeah, I can go through Squaw Valley and hit these 2 to 7 speed humps. If Doug has his way, he puts in, you know, 5 more speed humps. Or I can just go around. It'll make it more advantageous to go around.
Now, just a quick question. So if we take out the bridge, it's going to create more traffic. It's already, there's already 580 in 2015. I'm guessing that's getting closer to 1,000 every day. What does that cost to replace that road? Like, is that going to be something in the works? That, like you said, it's not made to handle traffic, but it's just as, I mean, probably just as dangerous as your route.
It's pretty narrow.
Yeah. It's narrow, and then people, you don't see the cars coming, and then they, if they're in the middle at all, there's going
to
be
Yeah, so the answer is there's no imminent plans to do anything with that portion of 190th. The reality is, it's going to be a conversation we're going to have, but the conversation changes just a little depending on whether it's a through street or it's just a provider to your neighborhood or Squaw Valley or the other alluvial places like that. So it's a conversation that I have to be had. Let's see, I have, I believe it's Lee next, and then ma'am, I'll come to you. Oh, yeah. Well, if you got something that directly addresses what he had to say, go ahead.
Yeah, I just...
Come up and introduce yourself, man.
I don't have that big a comment. I just was going to speak to something Andy said about the drunks coming from alluvial. Where 505 becomes 190, that is a hugely dangerous curve. People go off on the ice. People go off because they're drunk. People go off because they can't see. And that, as we have said, they barrel 190. They reach that corner. And I spoke to my husband this morning as we came around there. You can't see who's coming either way. Well, you can see somewhat coming from the south. But when you're going to the west, you cannot see what's coming. And people, I mean, I have driven it when people were coming around on the wrong side of the road.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just saying, that's dangerous.
But it is all dangerous, and let's be really clear about this. If you've been drinking to the point that you're trying to determine whether you're going on a major road or a private road, call a friend, call Uber, call somebody else. Yeah, don't go there. Lee.
So, Lee Searles, just a comment on the river valley. Could I have the aerial photo brought up? And this is the laser pointer. But try not to blind Luke. Right here is a very crucial point in Squaw Creek. Why? Because as the water comes downstream, it has to make a curve, and that outside curve right there maintains its position, I would say, partly because there's a levee here. So just to go back those 2 or 3 comments, I forget who said something about road removal. If you remove that road, you change the hydrology of the entire floodplain here. I wouldn't be surprised if this curve in flood, say, above a 10-year flood, 10s, 25s, 50s, 100s, help us if we have another 500. That is going to travel downstream, and it could actually alter the entire channel as extremely as to cut it off here. So the road removal is something that, if it's chosen as an option, it requires a lot of hydrological study to consider the downstream impacts as well as on that immediate site.
Yeah, I think you're 100% right. Actually, something that, that I believe Dean said was when it starts to back up, it actually doesn't flow into the field right there to the west from down to the curve you were pointing at. It's all the way up at the curve in your driveway, Tom, is where it starts to flow in. And you could easily see if there was not that roadway stopping it, you know, water's going to take the path of least resistance, right? So if there's nothing stopping it, it's going to cut its own channel through all that.
What I'm thinking, though, is that that road, which you're considering a dam and a help, is going to wash out. It's going to wash out pretty fast. I mean, it's daring to discuss when half of it was gone during one of his pictures. It cuts through it. I've seen it cut through the gravel to where they've had to come back and line dirt up on. I mean, it's going to have to be maintained if it stays there.
100%. But all I'm saying to you is, if it's not maintained, either publicly or privately, if it's not maintained, over time, you're going to see the channel of squaw shift and take up more and more of your property. Well, you better just know that.
We're all for ecology. We have CRP in numerous acres of our project. And, you know, try to...
So I tend to agree with Lee that that would take a lot of study if we're going to really hydrolyze. Whether the bridge stays or goes, as long as the squaw is being forced into that channel, we don't change the hydrology in this area. The second you allow it to cut a new pathway across what is in essence a dike right now, you're going to change the entire flow from your home south. You're going to change the entire flow of squaw. And we just need to look at that some more before we get there. Let's see. Who else would like to address us today? Anybody else? Is there, you know, are there any questions? So we spent, what, an hour and a half talking about this. My hope is that we've addressed, maybe not to everybody's satisfaction, but we've at least addressed or tried to address every concern that's been brought before us. Is there anything that we're missing that anybody can think of?
I just want to make one comment. One is thanks for taking the time to give
sure.
a lot of thoughtful input. I want to thank Darren and his guys. I mean, I think you've done a very nice job over the years maintaining the growth. That's, I'm sure, been a challenge. So you've done really a nice job.
Well, I appreciate that. We're fortunate to have Darren. Darren Moon is one of the finest engineers in the state of Iowa. We're lucky to have him. Yeah, yeah. Come up so we'll get you clearly on this.
Just the last point. If the bridge is removed, I would really want you to think long and hard about something pedestrian-wise, just because of all the people on that side. Like I said, it's just as scary for us to go up that way with kids, so it would be nice to have an option if that is removed. And so I don't think we had really talked about that, but somehow keeping that there as well.
Bruce, thank you. Darren, anything before we get to consideration of options? Anything else you want to add? Anything you want to touch on?
I think we pretty well covered it. Like I said, this isn't a consideration item on board today, but I just comment that the two reasons we're probably looking at doing something fairly quickly is, one, the bridge report shows we need to do something that bridge fairly soon if we're going to keep growing the traffic. And the other reason was, before Camden State traffic gets used to you, it's only going to get harder to close that in the future, I think. So that's kind of why we're looking at right now.
Well, and so full transparency, what we've been talking about, and so if anybody tells you, or tries to suggest that this is somehow a spur-of-the-moment conversation or it's just now coming up, that is just so inaccurate. I tried to lay that out earlier. This is a conversation that we've been having for at least 5 or 6 years. And one of the consistent themes, and it's basically been between Darren and I, and it's included both Loris and Marty, but it included other board members as well because the conversation has been going that long, was when the time comes that we close down 190th to replace this smaller bridge, which we're doing right now, that's when we need to have the full conversation, because it's much harder to reopen the whole stretch and then come back and talk about closing it again than it is to have it closed right now and then keep it closed. Once we get the new bridge open, we would close this one. And that is the real final impetus between us for us to have this conversation today. Did you decide you want? Yeah, come on up. Start by introducing yourself. I really want to make sure everybody gets their chance.
I just have a question. My name is Jamie Diamond, and my wife's parents own some property up on the northwest
side there. We obviously got this letter in the mail. They were out traveling out of town, that's why I'm here. But we got this letter in the mail. You mentioned that maybe Cameron in the States didn't get the same communication that some of the other people did. I'm just wanting to make sure that when the item is up for consideration, there will be more communication to the people that are affected so that they could attend another meeting to express more support or whatever needs to be done.
I'm not sure that that'll... So here's the problem for Cameron States. It really is they're outside of the boundary that we were drawing to do this. And if you start going to that one next subdivision, well, then are we including the people that are using it further west? Are we talking to the people in Boone County who are coming across on 190? And where do you draw the line?
Right, so I guess my concern would be that somehow Cameron Estates would find out, like, suddenly this is happening and want to register a bunch of complaints, and then this gets all...
Yeah, so we got a couple emails and a couple reach-outs from people in Cameron Estates, and they are kind of saying, and my response to that is pretty simple. Maybe it's overly simple, but it is, from the very first day there was talk of developing Cameron Estates, this conversation was part of it. And if the developer or builders who were well aware of this didn't happen to share that fact, that's hard for us to take that responsibility.
Sure. Mm-hmm. So I guess, I mean, are you making a decision today then to do this or not?
We're considering options, and I believe and hope that our county engineer is going to come out of here with a pretty clear direction for where this appears to be headed.
I guess, you know, my in-laws, I think, signed the letter that they gathered. So they're in support of moving the bridge. But I just didn't want... something else to happen later that they weren't able to, you know, voice more support to when other people maybe were trying to talk against it. So
one of the things kind of coming into the present here about notice, because there is an issue about how far out you go beyond. Okay. But Story County has a practice that the tentative agenda, which is usually 99% of the items on the agenda, are placed on our website with most of the attachments by noon on Fridays.
Okay.
And, of course, we don't meet until Tuesday morning. So that would be something I would advise for everyone to realize, that they can get to look and see if this item, and I would perceive that this item we would know several days in advance we want it on the agenda.
Right.
So that would be the best thing to do, and that would give them time over the weekend. And then on Monday by about 9 o'clock is when we try to get the, Shelley, as a matter of fact, is very good at this, okay, and the auditor's department, will the final agenda out there. So that's something to pack along.
Okay, great. Will do. Thank you.
Yep, absolutely. Thanks, Lord. Anybody else? Okay, so now we're to consider our options for this. Darren, as I see it, we've got really four options, right? Two major ones. One, we leave it open, or two, we close it. But within those, you got subcategories. If you leave it open, or you just leave it open short term, and we're going to have this conversation again when the bridge is truly at the end of life, or are we going to actually commit that the long term we're going to do this, and we're going to spend $1 to $3 million of today's dollars. Now, 5 years from now, that could look entirely different. If you close it, are you going to remove it immediately? Are you going to keep it open as a pedestrian bridge? And then within that, if you keep it open as a pedestrian bridge, is it a long-term deal where someday you're replacing it, where probably conservation would be replacing it with a pedestrian bridge down the road? Or is it just we're going to leave it open as a pedestrian bridge until such time as it's not even suitable for a pedestrian bridge? Is there an option that I'm not seeing in there?
The only thing left is how, what stretch of road, where the actual closure takes place. We'll have to work that in somewhere. But
you get there from what you decide to do. So the first big decision is it this board, based on what you know today, not a formal decision, is it this board's intent to move forward with closing it or keeping it open? Let's just start there. And I'll ask both of you, based on what you know, what you've heard today, where would you be headed on this? Lawrence, I'll start with you.
Sure. Everything I've heard has me leaning toward closing the bridge. Okay. I'll end that there. That's what the question is right now.
Marty?
the dollars drive a lot of our decisions, mm-hmm. and the dollar figures that we hear are very painful. I would follow that question or that statement up with a question. When it's looking at the state report, just looking at this bridge, when you say we would almost be immediately having to do something to maintain it in a safe fashion, how many dollars are you just talking there alone?
Like I said, I think at least the piling repairs, we could probably do those in-house, fairly inexpensive, $4,000 to $5,000, and then put some riprap on the one abutment. So that could be another $5,000.
I look at those pictures. I have lived next to bridges out in the country that nature's taken and spent many months waiting for the county to come back and put them up. And I know what it's like to reroute your traffic pattern. It was not a good thing, but I think nature is only telling us that there's going to come a rain event, that this is going not to be there one morning. And I think that just the numbers alone give me great pause.
Yep. So I've heard two closures. I think I tipped my hand all the way through this thing. Anybody in here who doesn't recognize that I'm one who's in favor of closure of this bridge, I think had one was listening real closely today. So you got three, and again, this is not a formal decision, but you got three supervisors that, based on what the information we have today, would be moving toward closure. So then I would ask the next question, and that is removal or maintaining as a pedestrian bridge. Again, not a formal decision, but just talking this through. What would it cost us to go in and remove this bridge, Darren?
That's something we probably try to do that in-house, and that's not something we've really done. We still need to make that decision on the 248. At this point, that we've left that one there with the plan to go and remove it with our own crews at some point. So I don't have a good dollar amount to put on that. But it'd be winter work, so it's kind of a time filler, so it wouldn't cost that much.
Yeah, and so now I'll tip my hand first on this. My preference would be to, for the short term at least, leave that bridge in place as a pedestrian bicycle kind of bridge. We continue to monitor it. And then we get to see down the road what happens with the conservation areas, with the public ground that we've got coming in, with potential greenways or even trails in the area, and how that might service it. But at this point, we say it's just for the life of that bridge, and any conversation beyond that bridge will be for a future board working with conservation to try to figure it out. That would be where I sit today on this. I'm going to start with Marty this time. Marty, where would you sit on the whole idea of taking it out for a pedestrian bridge at this point?
If it were moved to a pedestrian status, would you still go in and do the repairs we just talked about here a moment ago?
Maybe just one of the pile, and that one here is considering enough. Might do that one, just try to extend the life a little bit further. But that'd probably be about the extent of it.
I live around a bridge, I have several bridges, and I know growing up and taking my children to one of them, I get the dad story about visiting bridges. Kids have a great fascination with them. I think this is an amenity that's not provided for in the sense that we build these things for kids to enjoy what they do. And I would think if we have the ability to keep a structure that's already in place for small dollars, that we wait for it to end its life cycle, which I see it fast approaching, I would have no problems with leaving it in that sense. I think that the conversation turns to where you do the dead end, and the neighbors have made a very compelling case as to the west. When I think we work with them and seeing the development that's coming out of the ground, I think that the story will kind of write itself going forward in the future. But at this time, our touch is on this bridge, and I see this bridge is coming to an end as we know it.
Yep.
I'm for leaving the bridge in because of basically the reasons that Rick stated. I'm just fascinated. I went from intrigued to fascinated about the plan and the opportunities to go ahead and make this area not only a conservation area, as in, with the land, but also for the opportunities to put in a recreation area down the road. And so I don't want to do anything that would eliminate that or make it more expensive. So for the meantime, I'd want to leave the bridge up.
Okay, and then assuming that we were to close it, assuming that we were to leave the bridge, Marty touched on this, but the conversation would be, where do you close the roads? And for me, that is simply as far east as possible on the east side and as far west as possible on the west side. Now, that will require some logistical work because we're going to have to work with the abutting landowners to have adequate space to turn around not only private equipment, but county equipment that's coming in there. We would have to talk through, is there going to be any parking area at this point, or is there not going to be any parking area at this point, and maybe there will be down the road. Those kind of things would all logistically lead to us, but it makes no sense at all to me that we would continue to have vehicular traffic leading basically to nowhere. Now, that said, for the time being, I would tend to come down strongly that the county needs to maintain this portion, not as a roadway, but we need to maintain it at least as a path. But more importantly, from a hydrological perspective, we need to be maintaining it where we're not completely altering the flow of water before there can be a lot of study done. That would be my take on that. Boris, back to you.
I agree as far as the east and as far as to the west as possible. I identify with the concern that if there's parking lots or there's areas where people can park cars, they will. I got an opportunity to ride with one of our snowplow drivers in, I think it was February, and I was amazed at how tight those turns he could take, but I don't think he was a miracle worker. He said a little more angle or places like that. So I would, be there, east and west.
I think you've already addressed this. Would you want to address it again?
No, I have nothing else to add. I just, it's an unfortunate thing. I don't disagree. Alluvial and Prairie Moon are changing traffic patterns out there. I guess, as you spoke, that you have a one-off road here, and I know it's not a collector road in a true sense, but I would think that maybe that any future board is going to have to talk about what that road, how it's configured, but traffic will determine that, and development will too, but that's not our task before us today.
I will say with 190A portion, we have recently reduced the speed limits in there pretty drastically and try to slow that traffic down for safety. And we do have an overlay of that entire stretch planned next year, so we're going to kind of go from the seal coat to an actual pavement. And unfortunately, that doesn't include a lot of widening, but that's going to be difficult to do. That would be a major decision if we go that far.
Yeah. Good. What else do you need to hear from us today? I guess we need to talk about timing. So we've given very clear indication of where this is headed at this point. Now we need to talk about timing. From my perspective, Darren, timing remains what I've talked about for the last 5 years, and that is that we get to a final decision prior to that smaller bridge on 190th being completed. When, in your mind, does that bridge get completed?
Thinking we're 3 to 4 weeks out. We have to get a guardrail contractor and a pavement contractor in there so the schedules could plus or minus a week or two either way on that. But we're about a month out.
Yeah. So I'm suggesting that we keep this in front of us. And so how many public meetings do we have to go through to close the bridge? It requires a public hearing.
Actually, it doesn't just to close the bridge.
Okay.
If you vacated the bridge and the road right away, that would take a public hearing.
Okay.
The way we've done like 248, it's just you did every 2 years we do the update to the resolution, all the bridge postings, and that included to close that bridge. So there was no formal other than resolution on that. Now the other thing to take into account is the road portion. I think we can temporarily close that back further to the west, but then we're going to have to decide, is that going to be a level C road? Either make it level C or you vacate it, in my opinion. There's no way to keep it a public road but not allow access.
Absolutely, but we either, so we make it level C, we vacate it, or can we not transfer, have a conversation with conservation about transferring that stretch to conservation?
I don't think we could transfer the easement. Since it's by easement, we don't own the road right away. We couldn't transfer it to conservation.
But we could work with landowners for conservation to get an easement through there if conservation was so inclined.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so is that you're saying level B then?
No, it can't be level B because that would still allow traffic down it.
So we move level C.
Level C, you can lock the gate.
Yeah.
I can't see where landowners will be. I mean, you hear, listen to the concerns about the hydrology on what rain events could do to that road. Clearly, the bigger pictures alone tell a story of what could happen, and I don't think that they're empowered or equipped to maintain that road in a way that would keep it water if we didn't have some touch to it.
Correct. I think I'd prefer that land transfer option, work with the adjacent landlords to get an easement through there, and then we could actually close it back there, but yet have conservation, have an easement to maintain the road.
Well, it seems to be the story going forward.
So I think what I would ask, and Morris, this goes back to what you're talking about in making sure that we get as much engagement from the public and from anybody who would be affected as possible. My preference would be that we keep this in front of us for the next 2 weeks, and that we come back with what in essence would be a first reading of a resolution with no action next week. But we put together the resolution that spells out what we've laid out today, and then we hold it for one more week, and then deal with it that third weekend. So let's see, do my math for me. So that would be, what's our next meeting? September what?
5.
September 5th, yeah. And September 12th. And on September 12th, we look at taking action, but hopefully that will give everybody in the area a chance to see what we're working on and what the timeline is, and give plenty of opportunities for input over the next 2 weeks before a final decision is made. You guys comfortable with running this along that timeline?
I do, just for the fact that we have seen just the outreach from the community and the landowners around it, the homeowners, that I think that we would be well served to let everybody that reads the story that they will see and watches our video of the meeting that we just held, that I think that we will have further contact and we'll give them the opportunity to come speak with us.
Yeah. I'd like to just urge people, if there's anything that we've forgotten collectively or individually, certainly for me, roads and bridges were not my forte. I'm learning, so if there's anybody out there that would like to provide information or guidance, this is the opportunity within this time period to please do that, so that when the vote is cast, at least when I cast a vote, I feel that I've got a really good overhand view of everything.
Yeah, I think that's 100% right. I mean, it is not our job to always make everybody happy. We're just going to do the best we can with the information we have. But it is important that everybody who wants to weigh in has a chance to weigh in, be it coming to a meeting, be it calling us, email, however that is. And so I would just encourage all of you, talk to your friends and neighbors, make sure that they're putting in their 2 cents worth if they want to. Hopefully we're giving everybody enough time. Darren, are we giving you a reasonable time frame to get this in front of us and try to move to the end? So as I visualize this, if we make a final decision, take action on the 12th, that's still well before you finish off that 190th Street Bridge, and it could just be an effective date. At the same time you open the new bridge, you would close access to this bridge. And then we would work on expanding out to where ultimately the closure is going to be. That would happen over time.
Yeah, because that would have to vacate the road and take an actual hearing.
Right.
That can be done later.
Okay. So you've heard our full conversation today. Is there anybody who would like to weigh in one more time before we move on from this today? All right, we're going to take a 5-minute recess, and then we're going to come back and finish our agenda. Those of you that want to slip out, thank you. Have a great day.
Thank you.
All right. Yeah, Marty will be in just a
minute. Yeah, I know. I ran into him on the way out.
But I need Darren back, so I'm going to wait.
That's great.
All right. Darren, let's go ahead and get through this next one. Shelly, you ready?
I'm ready.
All right, so we're back in session. And now we're discussing the current 35-mile-an-hour speed limit on Arrowsmith Trail. Again, I'll tee this one up because I've had the conversation with a couple landowners out there. Arrowsmith, if you haven't driven it, it's kind of an interesting curvy country road, paved. We've seen some development out there over the last 10 or 15 years. The call that brought it to my attention where I went out is we actually had a slow, was it a 10-mile-an-hour a curve, a slow 10-mile-an-hour curve coming up, and then probably 20 or 30 feet past that, but before you got to the curve, was a 35-mile-an-hour speed limit sign, which was really confusing. Darren and I talked about that, and that sign has since been moved. But we need to have the full conversation of, is 35 miles an hour an appropriate speed limit for this road, specifically this stretch of road? We got a lot of private roads abutting that don't have any signage at all for controlled access. So with that, Darren, go ahead.
Okay. Yeah, we've looked at this. I've driven it many times in the past month just to get a feel for the speed. This was posted 35 miles an hour back in, I have a resolution here. I'll look at it. This is the road we're talking about. That's Arrowsmith. All these are private roads that come off of it. This is the only road that the county maintains. But that 35-mile-an-hour speed limit starts here off of Highway 69 and goes all the way up. It turns to gravel right about here, but the speed limit continues all the way up to where Arrowsmith turns north. So, like Rick said, it's a bit of a unique road. We don't have a lot of curvy roads in Story County. I worked in another county in Eastern Iowa. That's about all we have is curvy roads. So it's nice to have the straight roads, but this one's unique for us. In general, what you do when you set the speed limit is you set the speed limit for these straighter sections of road, but then the curves, you sign those individually with speed plate warnings. They're not enforceable, but it tells you to slow down. We have a 15-mile-an-hour posted speed curve here. This is a 10. That's about as low as we go. It's a pretty abrupt curve there. And then another 15 curve up at the top here. This is the area that we got the call from the resident that lives right here that was concerned about the speed coming around this curve. Like I said, it's got the speed plate at 10. It's hard to take that much faster than 10 or you've got to go off the road. But we did notice as part of that review there was the curve ahead sign was here with 10, and after it, it had the 35-mile-an-hour speed limit, so that was a little confusing. That's probably been like that for 30 years, just never noticed it. So we took the speed limit sign and moved that back to the south further. The other concern was children playing in this area, asking if we could put up the children at play signs. We generally do not put those signs out in public right away. They're found to be not very effective unless those kids are out there the majority of the time, which they're not. So people become accustomed to ignoring them. So what it does is give these people a false sense of security that those signs are taking care of them when they're really not. So very few people use those signs anymore. I told them private residents can put it just outside the road right away. They buy, Lowe's sells those children's slow signs they stick out in the front yard. That's probably the most effective thing they could do if they want to get their attention. But we don't generally put those signs in the public right away anymore. If we did, we'd put them at every house that had children. That's just not practical. This, Rick also talked about the stop sign, but also concerns the paved portion curves here, and this is a private gravel road that comes up to it. We currently have no stop sign here because that would be the way we have our rules now. Responsibility of the private subdivision to maintain the signs on their private road. I did a rough count throughout the county how many instances we probably have like that, and I got to 50 real quick. Yeah. So it's a lot of them that are out there. So that's something I think we're going to meet with the county attorney and talk about that a little bit, if we have some liability there or where we need to go with those.
So this is a conversation, so moving beyond the 35-mile-an-hour conversation, this is a conversation that I've asked for us to have. What responsibility we have and what's an appropriate level of responsibility on these public access private roads, not this road, but another road that we have that actually comes to Dayton Parkway or to Dayton Road, and it's called Dayton Parkway. So we signed it. The county put a sign up that said Dayton Parkway, but it's not a publicly maintained public road. There's no stop sign on it, and one of the people who lives back off of Dayton Parkway has decided, since there's no stop sign there, he doesn't have to stop. Everybody else has to stop for him. And I think gets a little bit of a kick out of pulling out in front of people, which is really unfortunate, but it's the reality. And so then you hear stories about this one where people who aren't accustomed to this will be coming, driving to the west along the gravel road, and there's no stop sign or anything there. You're just going straight, and all of a sudden you look to your right, and here comes another vehicle, and people are hitting the brakes. And so my question, very clearly, the way county policy currently reads, we don't put anything up here. And I tend to think that now that it's been brought to our attention that this is a potential issue, we have some liability. And so my question is, are we going to invest in something like yield signs on all of these? Or where maybe it's not a full stop, but we very clearly say to the people coming out of this private road, you have to yield to the other traffic and what that does to our liability. So it's a conversation, and I think it's bigger than just Darren and the county attorney. I actually think planning and development has a role in this conversation in terms of how we classify these private roads. Story County is a little unique in this area, or at least I believe, from what I've seen, Darren, we're pretty unique in how we're doing this. And so I've asked that we have a full review of all our policies dealing with these kind of roads.
I just want to also point out, as I mentioned, this right up here is the beginning of the 35. We also discovered an issue up there. This is Aerosmith North this way. That's facing west. This is where the speed limit sign starts. It was up higher, and it was stuck. The post was only about a foot above the ground because it's a really steep hill there, and it didn't take vegetation very long to cover up that sign. It was completely covered, so we did move that sign down to the ditch bottom and make it more visible. So that's another change we did as part of this review. But other than that, I just wanted to remind the board how speed limits are set. This is a little hard to read, but I have this pamphlet. If you ever want this, I can get it to you. What it's showing is there's an 85th percentile speed. In the past, the DOT would request and they'd come out and do the speed study for us. They no longer do those, but at the time we did this one, the DOT did it. They come out with radar gun, check the speeds of all the traffic going through there. They don't take the average speed. They take the 85th percentile, a little faster than that. And they determine at the bottom of that curve, the lowest amount of accidents are caused when you set it at 85th percentile. Because if you get too slow, people are going to get frustrated and start passing in areas they're not supposed to pass. You get too fast, of course, you're going to have people going too fast for conditions. So that's where we set our speed limits. This is the resolution board passed. What year do we have here? 1978. That 35 mile an hour was set. That's the letter back in.
Made that motion.
Letter back from the DOT, saying they did the speed study for us, and this is their results. This is 35 for that whole stretch of Aerosmith. The road itself, the alignment is still the same as when it was studied, and it's really the alignment that determines that speed. It's not the enough amount of traffic that has very little impact on the speed limit because interstates are posted much higher and they have a lot higher traffic. That's not a big factor in there. It's mainly the feel you get when you drive that road. That's what most people drive, and that's how they set that 85th percentile speed. I still feel like these long stretches, you feel very comfortable driving 35 yet. And so I think it's signed appropriately, and then with the curves, with the advisory speeds on them, I think it's still appropriate.
So I've driven it a half dozen times since we started having this conversation, and I really believe that for a large majority of the road, 35 is appropriate, with the exception being the two major curves, and then there's one fairly hilly, curvy area, kind of the part that runs northeast. That may be a little less, but I think
also if I'm going to be close to two, well, that's the area you're going to get cars getting frustrated and start to pass, and you make a more dangerous situation. And we have checked the accident records. In the past 10 years, there's only been three or four accidents, and most of them were single vehicle in the winter, and I don't see anything that's really road-related.
So I just want to commend you. I think moving the speed limit signs was completely appropriate. You and I both promised the landowners that we spoke to that we would have this conversation. We're having this conversation. Lawrence Marty, unless you feel differently, I don't see anything that warrants a change off the 35 mile an hour speed limit. It's just up to you based on what you see.
Looking at the one picture of where you were talking about raising the speed limit, is that an IBRM issue as far as brush clearance?
No, there's very little I could say. That's the only sign I think I've seen in the county where the post was less than a foot high above the actual ground, so it didn't take long for it to grow. That was a unique situation.
Oh, yeah.
Good.
My husband and I drove it last night. We went out to West Pearson Park and had a picnic supper, and so we took the back way. I think 35 is appropriate. He drove 30. Okay, but
that was his choice.
You know, I understand, but yeah. I think it looks it's appropriate, and I like your advice. I'm sure some of the people with the kids said, well, why should we have to invest in these little children playing signs or whatever, but that's the only suggestion I can think of, too. Yeah, so good.
Good. All right, anything else from us? Not changing anything, so good to go. Darren, thanks for your time today. Good job. All right, so we're going to go back now. We're going to go to item number 5, which is discussion and consideration of Herta's request. Since it doesn't look like Julia's going to make it today, Deb, we'll just ask you to handle this. So this is a conversation that started several weeks ago, and really appreciated everybody digging in. I think, as I said at that time, it sounded like something the county should absolutely be involved in at some level. Just wanted her to formally make the request. We got that now. Deb, what can you tell us?
All right. Julia sends her regrets for not being able to be here today, but good afternoon. And yes, this stems from conversation that was had on August 15th, and her is looking at offering educational forums in different smaller communities throughout the county. I don't know if those dates have been established yet or not, but I know we're definitely looking at getting that set up toward the end of the month, as Julia indicated in her letter. And she is requesting for Herta to use the county's social media outlets, specifically Facebook and our website, and then would provide us with all the materials. Everything would be ready to go. It would just be a matter of getting those to us and then having staff help get those items posted within our social media outlets. And that would hopefully broaden the scope in terms of getting the information out to individuals to be able to attend
So this isn't something that Story County has traditionally done in the past, which I kind of attribute to we haven't been that active in social media. We haven't done these things. Is there a reason, Deb, that we wouldn't do this and wouldn't do it, frankly, for any of our asset-funded entities that they requested that we notify the public on something that they're going to hold?
Correct. This is the first request of this kind that I recall ever receiving from one of the nonprofit entities. I think it's a good use of the county's social media outlets, and I would be prepared for other requests to come forward if the board were to approve this particular request, and I don't know if we would need some kind of a policy around that use.
Yeah,
I would think there would be people that we might not be inclined to provide our platform to.
Well,
I think a policy might be appropriate.
Yeah, I think I agree with that. So I'm gonna go to Loris. I think we're gonna want to hear from Leanne Harder at some point in this conversation. But Loris, you're the one who brought this forward, this concept forward originally. Give me your thoughts on what Herta's request is.
Well, I think this works just perfectly, which is what the whole goal was.
Sure.
As I got overly ambitious and sidetracked, okay? And so it's great. Deb worked with Julia. You know, everybody's now on the same page. This works out well. Interestingly, I just sent out an email to both Leanne and Deb, was it yesterday or Friday? I don't know. It's all run together. Okay. Because I asked about something else. You know, and I brought this up too about did we have a social networking policy? Did we have a web link policy? And Leanne provided them. We do already. Okay. Now, whether Leanne says she thinks it should be tweaked or dead or whatever, but our linking policy definitely covers our nonprofits. Okay. So that I think we're good. But I'll let Leanne talk about it. We might down the road might want to look
there,
a little bit.
So Leanne, is there something in our existing policy that would preclude us from being able to do this?
I don't think so.
Okay.
As long as it's an asset, one of the agencies funded through the asset process or something, an entity that receives direct funding from Story County, there is a as Laura's mentioned, nonprofits, and there's a criteria that the board set up with the adoption policy. That being said, I think it would be worthwhile in the next couple months to review both policies. It may be unnecessary that we have two separate policies, too. It may just be a web linking and social media policy to lessen some confusion.
Yeah, that's easy.
So then if it's appropriate, I'd ask you and Deb just to kind of work in a review of those two policies and see where we need to head, make a recommendation to the board as we go. In the meantime, it sounds to me like we can deal with each one of these requests on a one-off basis. As we get a request, we'll deal with that on the merits of that request. Good. So that leads us to this. We can have a motion to approve Heather's request.
I would move that we approve Heather's request to use the county's social media outlets to promote their upcoming community informational forum.
I'll second that.
Motion and second. Further discussion?
None.
Olson?
Aye.
Chief?
Aye.
Sanders? Aye. It passes. Thank you. Next is consideration of minutes from the 22nd.
Move consideration of the minutes as presented.
Second.
Cheney?
Aye.
Olson?
Aye.
Sanders? Aye. Personnel actions, quite a few this week.
I would move considerations of the personnel items as presented.
I would second.
Cheney?
Aye.
Olson?
Aye.
Sanders? Aye. Consent agenda board?
I would move that we approve the consent agenda as presented.
Second.
Olson?
Aye.
Chee?
Aye.
Sanders? Aye. No public hearing items today. Additional items, discussion, consideration of Story County reimbursement for $1,200 for cropland damages resulting from a prescribed fire. Deb?
All right. I provided the board with a memo about an incident that happened on April 17th of this year. Conservation staff were... they were performing a prescribed fire. It progressed into an individual's corn stubble field and burned some of those, some of that land. Conservation had notified our insurance carrier, so they were involved. And I talked with Brenda Snyder with ICAP. She was the representative who was handling this particular claim. She had talked with the landowner about what had happened, and he told her that there were approximately 120 acres that were ruined as a result of the fire. Now, Conservation had provided me with a map this morning in terms of their generous look at how many acres were actually ruined by the fire, and it's closer to 50 acres. Though the landowner indicates that there was nutrient loss as a result of the fire that then increases that acreage to 120 acres. And so Brenda Snyder with ICAP said, you know, at this point, ICAP really can't determine whether or not $1,200 was lost with this fire in this cropland. The landowner indicates that he was going to plant 120 acres of beans, but because of the incident, he was not able to do that. And so ICAP is really kind of referring it back to the county to make a decision on whether or not we want to go ahead and pay out those damages. I ran this by Ethan Anderson in the county attorney's office, and he thought it was an appropriate amount, plus we would also then want full release of any future liabilities that this landowner might be able to come back to the county on and say happened to the land as a result of the fire.
Sure. And so the other part to this is you have this landowner, but we've also got a utility company where we got into their pole a little bit. We haven't heard back from them, or the insurance carrier has not heard from them at this point. We've supplied them with all the information. So for me, I think... probably 120 acres is a generous estimate of what was damaged. I think it was less than that. Clearly there was some damage done. Clearly our prescribed fire got a little bigger than we intended. And so in my view, we do have some liability. I'll remind both of you, we got a $10,000 deductible. So whatever's paid here is going to be straight out of the county coffers. And from my perspective, $1,200, as long as it includes a full release from all future liability, is maybe a little high, but it's high in the reasonable category, and firm idea is how to just move on from this. Thoughts, questions?
Burning is a management tool conservation uses, and I think they do a good job with it. It comes with a risk. We have just a story about a risk that got away from us. I don't think that the dollar amount gives me great heartburn. I'm sorry that this did happen. I know that you don't have to tell me to be careful. They're careful and they do it anyway. So I have my acceptance of this would be with a caveat that we are released from any future liabilities.
I agree, and I think $1,200 seems reasonable, given we don't know really what the impact was, but to have the release, I'll make a motion that we approve the reimbursement for $1,200 for crop life damages resulting from the prescribed fire in April.
And we will pursue a release of the county for any future liability.
It's contingent upon the full release.
Right.
Okay. Absolutely. You good with that?
I'm good with that one.
I would second that.
You'll second it. And I just want to underscore something Marty said. We do a great job with prescribed fires. Occasionally, when you do what we do, you're going to have an issue. We step up and deal with the issue when it comes. Anything further?
No.
Olson?
Aye.
Cheney?
Aye.
Sanders? Aye. The settlement is approved pending full release.
Thank you.
Thanks, Deb. Good job. Next is, no agency reports, no departmental reports. We dealt with the first two on other reports. Now we're overview of notification procedures for Urban Renewal Area Program, Leanne Harder. Hi, Leanne.
Good morning. Or afternoon.
Both.
Well, this was follow-up to the item that Mr. Art Greiner brought forward to the public last week under public comment. He did question the process that we used to notify the taxing entities of pending changes to the Urban Renewal Area through our Urban Renewal Area Program. I did outline the process I followed for the board and the memo that was provided today. Just some highlights. There's kind of two approaches. It really depends on whether or not new properties are being added, which amends the curb ordinances. I mean, new properties being added, new properties from which the valuation, basically that they are added for the valuation for the TIF revenue. If those are added, then we notify every taxing entity in Surrey County. It's a more expensive mailing because it's not just a letter. It's a package. We include the draft plan, the notification, and then the map, too, as part of the draft plan. So about $2 a mailing, give or take. And that's 210 mailing labels. Then on the flip side, when no new lands are involved, we just notify those entities where the projects are located. And that can be a simple one. In this case, we had four areas where projects were located. It was a little bit more complicated because Boone County was involved with the Slater's recent annexation. Those are smaller mailings, less expensive, but quite honestly, between the two, I prefer the larger mailings because I don't have to sit and delve and figure out which taxing entity should get what. It is easier. You just know it's blanket one, it goes out. But again, it can be great more expense than the smaller one. There are some different approaches we could do. We can amend the policy so that we don't send out the plan, instead of summarize, but we need to be cognizant of the code bio. It requires us to share the draft changes to the plan, but there's a way we can do that. Links to the website, information such as that. By following up, this is just an overview of what we do. I do have my work program to bring the overall economic development policies to the board later. But with this and just maybe some other items I have in my work program, if you'd like it, I could find time in earlier September to bring it forward to start that discussion now. Just this matter, but then others as well in regards to economic development policies.
Yeah, so my initial feeling would be we should keep this as simple as we can possibly keep it, and in my mind that means doing the same thing every time, regardless of what we're adding from which, whether project or from the revenue side. And so I would tend to come down on a policy that says we're going to send it out to everybody, and anybody who wants to comment can comment. The concept of one Surrey County, and in this case a little bit of Boone County as well. I don't see a reason for you to pull it out of the time frame that you have in your current work program unless somebody can convince me that there's some kind of immediate need for Leanne to get to this ahead of some other things rather than doing it in the time frame she was looking at doing.
All I would ask is if Leanne could just provide, pardon, you did ask the question. Here's the rationale that you gave us. Other than that, I appreciate your diligence on this and the clarity with which you informed us, because I think if you were to go to the trouble to read this document, I think you'd have a much clearer understanding how the county goes about doing this.
I appreciate when we add, I'm using the word appreciation in a different way. I'd rather do the larger mailing. Again, it's just simple, straightforward. I don't have to stop and think, because a lot of times you have to stop, well, was it Richland or was it Sherman Township?
Yeah.
And it's just a blanket one.
I think also, $440 is an expense. It's only once a year.
Right.
And I think Arden had a point, Mr. Brainerd had a point, about that everybody should receive notice, because some of these are multi-year and they go on and they go off, et cetera. So then I think it's more thorough. I do have a question, though, about did you want to just bring this part before us in September? You want to bring the whole?
The entire economic development policy.
So one of my,
if you wanted to move that up and have that discussion earlier, leave it till I was planning on bringing it mid-October.
Oh, mid-October, because I know we at one point we've been considering November. I would appreciate at least leaving it on the work plan for mid-October to November.
Yeah.
Like, I go to the housing conference in a couple weeks, and
I'll
have a better idea what maybe options as we discuss the housing.
I don't buy that we're gonna lose anything in that 6 week period.
I didn't know. I was just thinking as I was drafting this, I'm like, well, do you want to have it sooner rather than later? I can move some things around and move it up.
Yeah, absolutely. Do we need to get any direction, or have you got enough? It's already on your work program, so it's already coming to us. Appreciate the notification. As Marty said, please share that with Mr. Greiner so that he knows we did, in fact, address it. Super. Thank you. Public forum number two. This is an opportunity for members of the public to comment on items not on today's agenda. What about it? Nothing? All right. Seeing no one moving to the microphone. Liaison assignments, I think it's Marty this week.
You missed an opportunity to see your facilities shine yesterday morning, because we were hosting a regional mental health meeting here, and this room had not gotten a work order was not placed for them to configure it, and in the space of a half hour, 35 minutes, it went from this to what we use.
Yep.
That's good on Cal, that's good on John, that's great on Aaron, because I think he did a lot of heavy lifting. Other than that, I'll sort of list the fact that we're starting a United Way campaign. Renee Sweet and I will be co-hosting it here, and we'll have further information going forward.
Perfect. Thanks, Mark. Morris.
I'm going to keep it very short, too. I was elected treasurer of the Community and Family Resources Board. That's just a switch for thanks. So my switch positions, basically. I guess they trust me with the second signature on the checklist now. And I was very inspired last week. By the 3 days I spent down at ISAC, scrapping all kinds of notes and thoughts and miscellaneous. And with that, we're just moving forward into a new month, a new business.
Perfect. Staff meeting at 2 p.m. today for anybody who is so inclined. With that, I take a motion to adjourn. So moved.
And I'll second.
All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
And we're adjourned.